Meeting of the House Committee on Energy and Environment to order. And you will notice that we're moved around a little bit. We're just testing you. Because when you leave, you have to fill out a form and write down who was where and where the regular place is. So.
And whether there's anything
I don't
smart.
Know if I
yeah,
can do that.
So we have a few absentees today, and I'm sure they have good excuses, but we're going to deal with them later. So you're all welcome today, and we have a very interesting informational meeting. And we're going to start with one of my personal favorite agencies, and with Andy Ginsberg and Matt Krumenauer. They're going to talk about green energy tech in public buildings. So, and you'll know that all the agencies are my favorite. So. Yeah.
Good morning, Chair Boone, members of the committee. My name is Andy Ginsberg, and I'm the administrator for the Planning, Policy, and Technical Analysis Division of the Oregon Department of Energy. And, of course, some of you probably remember me from my former role at DEQ, but now I'm with the Department of Energy. And with me is Matt Krumenauer, who's a senior policy analyst in my division. We're here today to provide an overview of green energy technology in public buildings, along with a primer on biomass energy in Oregon. And while biomass currently does not qualify for the public building green energy program, we're providing this background information to assist the committee as you consider potential future proposals to advance biofuels in technology in Oregon. So the Public Building Green Energy Program began in 2007 with the passage of House Bill 2620. The bill requires public bodies to spend 1.5% of the total contract price of a building on solar technology. Public buildings include state agencies, local government, cities, counties, special school districts, but doesn't include the members of the Oregon University system. The requirement applies to any new public building that has a construction cost of over $1 million or to a reconstruction or renovation of a public building that's over $1 million and also over half of the insured value of the building. The building must be owned or controlled by a public body, and it must either be used for conducting public business or occupied by employees of the public body. In 2012, the law was amended by Senate Bill 1533, and it became the 1.5% for green energy technology. Green energy technology is defined as renewable technology that includes solar technologies, such as photovoltaics and solar hot water, as well as geothermal systems, where the geothermal source is over 140 degrees, and it's used to provide heating or make electricity. But it does not include ground source heat pumps. The law was further amended in 2013 by House Bill 3169, and that was done to better accommodate the geothermal technologies by allowing green energy technologies to be installed off-site if that's more cost-effective than on-site and if the location is close by and it's for new generating capacity. So as a result, the local public body has the option of locating the technology either on-site or off-site, and it can do it off-site if it considers the technology to be inappropriate on-site. In either case, though, the energy needs to be used at the on-site location of the building. The original House Bill 2620 had reporting requirements for our department, that was on two specific dates, and then in 2013, annual reporting was added. House Bill 3169 also specified reporting requirements for the local for the public bodies to the Department of Energy. And before this, we had already required reporting by rule, but it was added by statute in 2013. So the public bodies with the building projects that's subject to the law are required to report the project information onto our website. The report's due after the building permit is issued, before the construction begins, and it has to summarize all of the projects, and then we summarize that and provide that information to you. If the public body plans to install the green energy technology at an alternate site, then it must have that decision reviewed by a technical review panel. The review panel includes a professional engineer or an architect. It would have a solar or geothermal expert, a member of the public body, and it would be chaired by our agency. The public body must provide the information about the site and the cost to the technical review panel. And if the public body considers the green energy technologies to be inappropriate both on-site and off-site, it must also submit its reasoning to the technical review panel. The panel would review and make its recommendations in writing, but the public body makes the final decision on whether the green energy technology is appropriate. And that information would be reported also to our department. So then if the public body decides that it's not appropriate to install green energy technology either on-site or off-site, if no state funds are used for the building, then there's no further requirement at that point. But if state funds are used, then the public body has to hold 1.5% of the construction costs and utilize them at a future time when a future construction is undertaken. And the amount must be set aside and added to the 1.5% for the new project. And the law does not set a time limit for how long those funds have to be held. So that's a quick summary of the 1.5% for green energy technology. I'd be happy to answer any questions about that program before I turn it over to Matt to talk about biomass technologies.
Any questions? Representative.
I was wondering what the 1.5% typically adds to the cost of the building. I mean, is it an additional 1.5%, or does it translate to 30% more to build the building to make it comply with the 1.5%?
Chair Boone, Representative Whitsitt, it's 1.5% of the total construction cost, so it could theoretically add 1.5% to the cost of the building, but it would be of the amount spent on the building, 1.5% would have to be used for the green energy technologies.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Benz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on that question, do we know the total amount that this program has now resulted in having been spent on green technology?
Chairman Representative Benz, I don't have that information, but I can get back to you with that.
Follow up. The original thought was, I think, to help drive green technology as a part of buildings in general. So I guess the question one would ask in looking at the program is it achieving that outcome? So unless we knew the total amount of money that's been invested in those green technologies, and then we knew whether it's achieving that purpose, kind of hard to evaluate. I know today's, I guess, the report is to say this is how it's working. The reason I bring up the issue is we, after working 31 years, got a bond passed in the City of Ontario for our schools. 1.5% of that $18 million had to be spent on green technology that resulted in a set of solar panels on top of the building. I kind of would have rather had that money spent on student educational stuff as opposed to those solar panels on top of the building. So, but maybe you're here to tell us that investment in the long run is the better for all of us. To know that, we of course know how much, we need to know how much has been invested by virtue of this program and whether it's achieving those outcomes.
Chair Boone, Representative Benz, that information is included in our annual reports. I just don't have it at my fingertips, and I'd be happy to provide that to you. There hasn't been a lot of construction in the last couple of years. That's likely to pick up in the coming year, so we'll get back to you with that information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, Matt.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm honored to be here. My name is Matt Krumenauer. I'm a senior policy analyst at the Oregon Department of Energy, and I was asked to give an informational overview on bioenergy in Oregon and a little bit of status on how that industry is faring. Biomass energy is unique in that it requires fuel. Unlike solar or wind energy, which you don't have to contract for that energy source, in the bioenergy world, you do need to contract for your fuel source, and that opens up a series of other unique challenges to this type of technology, but also a number of opportunities that I'll go through this presentation. I'm going to go fairly rapidly. Most of it's pictures and a few slides for you to take away. If I'm going too quick, please stop me, but I know you have a packed agenda. I'd like to start with this slide, mostly to ground myself in the fact that biomass is not one thing. Bioenergy is not one thing. When we talk about biomass, we're talking about different types of biomass or feedstocks that are available from our farms, from our forests, from our industries that create byproducts of different types of manufacturing. And we can use that different type of biomass, as shown in the middle, in different types of conversion technologies that are more or less appropriate for the different types of biomass that we have available. And then on the bottom is the different types of energy that we can produce from this material. Not just electricity, we can also use biomass to provide space or process heating for buildings or industry. And we can also use this to produce transportation fuels, which I used to say also made biomass energy unique, but then we started putting electric vehicles on the road, so it's not unique in that aspect. So what I'm going to do quick is give you an overview of what the biomass industry energy industry in Oregon looks like, what types of feedstocks and facilities we have in the state, talk a little bit about how this is meeting some of the key outcomes for our natural resource-based industries and the state's objectives, and then give you a real brief overview of some of the policies and programs we have in place and a summary of what the state's investment to date has been in this industry. Here's a map of the different types of bioenergy facilities that we have here in Oregon. There's about 7 biofuel manufacturers making diesel or ethanol. We've got about 10 wood pellet manufacturing facilities located in the state, a number of different landfills that have methane capture and energy recovery systems on site. We have about 21 anaerobic digesters, about 17 woody biomass combined heat and power systems, a number of other facilities. I'm going to go through a couple of these in a little bit more detail. In the slides, I also have some bullets of what I'm saying just as takeaway. I'm not going to go through those again. On the woody biomass side, I mentioned we have about 17 combined heat and power facilities. At least 6 of those are currently idle right now, and many of the remainders are operating at less than capacity for a variety of different reasons. Most of these, actually, every single one of them, except for one, is located at a mill site where it produces electricity that's either used on site or exported onto the grid, as well as thermal energy that's used to provide the energy for the dry kilns or other process needs on site in a cogeneration or combined heat and power setup. What I don't have on this map is the other industrial facilities that are using biomass just for thermal energy. They use some of their residual materials to fire a boiler, also to power their kilns. It's probably about 30 of those facilities around the state as well in the primary or secondary forest products manufacturing. A few examples of the different types of feedstocks that are used. Primarily and traditionally, it's been mill residuals on the top right, which are usually the lowest cost, most available, and highest quality feedstock. They're generated right on site, either the bark or sawdust or shavings that result from the lumber production process. On the left is forest slash that's generated from forest management or harvest activities, often at the landing. We can use that material as fuel and provide an alternative to open burning of that material out in the woods or letting it decompose, which can be a value-added use for that material. And then increasingly, as I show on the bottom, we're seeing more and more of the residuals from forest health restoration treatments being used to produce energy, which helps not only reduce the amount of field burning that can happen out in our woods, but also can help contribute to those forest restoration activities and help spread the limited dollars for those activities a little bit further by adding value to that material, which otherwise doesn't have a market. A few examples of different facilities in the state. The top one here is Evergreen Biopower. It's located at the Ferris Lumber Mill, just in Lyons here. It's about a 10-megawatt facility. They use all of those different types of feedstock. They generate electricity that's then sold onto the grid, and then they use their thermal energy to heat their dry kilns. On the right-hand side is Rough and Ready. Very similar type of facility, but it's a bit smaller. It's 1.2 megawatts, located down in Cave Junction. And then on the left, bottom left, is actually an idle mill. This is out in Prairie City, and it is currently idle. But just an example, we have these at various parts of, in various areas of the state.
Switch over a little bit to biomass thermal facilities. Back in 2009, we had about three of these in the state. Now we've got about 20. Most of these were installed in the 2011-2012 area. They provide space heat to hospitals, schools, other buildings, including some agricultural operations. On the left is the Oak Ridge Elementary School, one of the examples of the schools that have installed a biomass boiler. Behind the children there is a fuel storage silo. So that's full of probably about 10 to 15 tons of wood pellets that's used to heat the school. On the top is the Blue Mountain Hospital out in John Day. This hospital, after installing this biomass system, is saving about $100,000 to $150,000 a year on their energy. And whereas they used to import the fuel that they use to heat the hospital, they're now buying wood pellets from just down the street at Mulhere Lumber Company. So they're reinvesting the energy or the dollars they do spend on energy right into their local economy and saving money at the hospital on top of that. In addition, this is a critical access hospital, and this type of system, being able to provide fuel locally and being able to store fuel on site that's a renewable fuel, helps add resiliency to that hospital's energy system and help manage some of the risk that could happen if there were disruptions in its traditional fuel source. So a nice story. The other aspect of a lot of these facilities is some of these biomass boilers that have been installed are actually manufactured right here in Oregon or built right here in Oregon. One of the manufacturers is actually located in St. Helens. And then the bottom right-hand side is Steve Hesacker standing in front of a little biomass gas fire at his farm. I actually had a chance to sit down at his kitchen table and talk with him as he was considering this project. And what he was looking at is a big pile of blanks and shells and twigs from his harvest operations that he had to pay a lot of money to get rid of. And he said, I also have to pay a lot of money for the fuel I'm using to dry my hazelnuts. Why can't I switch those? And so he installed this gasifier that now uses his residual material from his hazelnut harvests to produce the energy he needs to dry his hazelnuts and also to heat some of his buildings. So a nice example in the agricultural industry of how these systems can integrate into an existing business and provide some benefit. As I mentioned, most of these facilities are using wood pellets that are manufactured right here in Oregon, but there are increasingly facilities that are either using or seeking to use wood chips that are directly from forest management treatments or other materials. Switching technologies a little bit, those are all combustion-based technologies. I'm moving into anaerobic digestion, which is basically microorganisms digesting organic material and turning that into biogas. I mentioned we have about 21 of these facilities. A little over half of those are located at wastewater treatment facilities in the state, which they've really been a leader in this industry. The remainder are located at dairy farms, food processing facilities, and we also have one merchant biogas facility in the state. Here's some of the feedstocks they use. These facilities can use agricultural residuals like grass straw. They can also use pre- and post-consumer food waste and turn that material into energy and other co-products. I'll get into that a little bit. It provides an alternative to recover energy from these materials instead of landfilling those or otherwise managing them. So it can be a real benefit to some other objectives we have. There's also a lot of nutrients that are encased in these waste products that, if not recovered, are buried in our landfills and are otherwise unavailable. We have some facilities in the state that are actively recovering those materials. I mentioned the wastewater treatment industry. One of the big challenges that they have, and one of the leading causes of overflows in the treatment works, is from grease that ends up into the pipes. This waste grease from homes, from restaurants, from other institutional facilities, has a really high energy content if it's used in a digester, but it clogs up the drains. So what some of the wastewater treatment facilities have begun to do is install receiving stations to take this waste grease directly, inject it into their anaerobic digesters, increasing their biogas production and increasing their energy production and reducing the expense they have in trying to remove this material from the landfill. Another example of how there's other benefits that can be provided from biomass energy outside of just the renewable energy.
What is that picture in the lower right corner?
Oh, that's a sewer cap in a street with the sewage coming up.
Nice.
Yeah.
I didn't take that picture, thankfully. Mm-hmm. And then the top is, I think, donuts. I thought it was appropriate for the morning. And then, of course, manure is something we use in the state to produce energy. I'll show you an example on the right-hand side is a picture of Lochmead Dairy. Those tanks that you see, the blue tanks, are where the manure is actually digested and turned into biogas. And then it's used in that little storage container. There's a cogeneration facility in there, about 190 kilowatts, that's burning that biogas to generate electricity, returning the heat to the digester tanks to maintain the temperature needed, and then exporting the renewable energy back onto the grid. The top left is an air photo of the Gresham Wastewater Treatment Facility. They're one of the facilities that has installed a grease receiving station, and partly through that and the solar installation you see, they will be becoming completely energy independent, which is a pretty good accomplishment, especially considering in many communities these wastewater treatment facilities are the largest energy users. Moving water takes a lot of energy, and they move a lot of it. And then the bottom picture is JC Biomethane. It's a new facility that was built and commissioned just this past year down near Junction City, and it's actually taken grass straw, food processing residuals, and food waste out of the Portland metro area, turning it into renewable energy, but they're also recapturing nutrients from that material, which they're then applying to some of the grass fields and some of the other fields that are right across the street from this facility, recovering those nutrients so that those farmers don't need to import that material, and providing another renewable co-benefit. It's also co-located with a composting facility, so they're able to bring the food waste out of the Portland metro area, digest it, extract those renewable fertilizers and renewable energy, take some of the effluent, mix it with the compost, and deliver that back up into the Portland metro area. So a real good example of sort of closing the loop, maybe even twice or three times. So that kind of leads into some of the importance that these facilities can provide. I mentioned earlier, they really can provide a solution to waste or materials management for our key natural resource-based industries, like our food processing industry, our forest products industry. It can help provide additional revenue streams. I mentioned the Malheur Lumber Company. When they installed a pellet manufacturing facility, they were able to take advantage of the sort of the changing supply profile from the national forests and use less smaller diameter material, but also create another product line in addition to their traditional lumber products. We can also leverage natural resource objectives that we have in the state. I mentioned a little bit earlier about how we can help support some of the forest restoration activities that are happening, also providing an alternative to burning that material in slash piles helps improve our air quality and can help contribute to those objectives. On the anaerobic digestion side, removing some of the organics from the landfills is an important goal of the state, as is helping manage the manure and the nutrients on farms and improving the quality of our soils. These can all help contribute to those type of objectives. And then, of course, the renewable energy benefits that we get from these facilities, as well as those renewable co-benefits that are not always valued. So real quickly, I'll transition into some of the different programs and policies that have been established. This first excerpt is from one of the statutes that was created in 2005 as a result of Senate Bill 1072, establishing the state policy of supporting these types of facilities and supporting the benefits that they can provide to our forests and other types of resources. Many of these biomass facilities are eligible for the Renewable Portfolio Standard. We have a Renewable Fuel Standard as well in this state. These are also eligible for the same types of net metering and other utility regulatory programs that have been established. And there is actually an exemption in our Energy Facility Signing Council for certain types of biofuel manufacturing to try to smooth the development pathway for these types of facilities. We also have a number of different programs that are available. We have a biomass producer or collector tax credit program. We have some projects that we've begun to implement. The Wood Energy Cluster Project is one example. We're partnering with the Department of Forestry, some of the federal agencies, and some local nonprofits to target development of small wood energy projects where they can help leverage some of the forest restoration activities that are happening. We have an energy loan program that can provide financing to these programs. We do have an energy incentives program that many of you are aware of that can still provide some support to these facilities. And then, of course, the Energy Trust of Oregon also can provide some assistance through their programs in certain parts of the state. Quick summary of the investment that has been made in the state since 2000. It's been about $147.7 million. You can kind of see the breakout there. Most of this was from the Business Energy Tax Credit Program. As we transition into the new energy incentive program, we're still seeing some interest in bioenergy facilities, but the resources, of course, are not what they were. But you can see there's been a good deal of investment in a lot of these different types of facilities. The biomass producer collector tax credit, I provided a little bit more detail here. This is a breakout from 2010 of the different types of feedstocks that have been supported and the amounts that have been given. This program is quite a bit different from the other incentive programs we have in that it provides a volume-based incentive for the biomass that's delivered to a biomass energy facility. So, for example, woody biomass. If you deliver that type of material from the forest to one of those cogeneration facilities, you're eligible for $10 a dry ton for each ton you deliver. Same thing with these other types of feedstocks. I included the two pie charts at the bottom just to show that there's been changes in this program over time. In 2010, when we began the certification program, woody biomass was the largest portion. Due to changes since that time, as well as a change in the way that the tax credit was calculated in 2012, the amount going to woody biomass has dropped. The amount going to manure has increased, primarily from new facilities being built. So it just shows some of the changes that have occurred over time in this program, and I'd be happy to talk a little bit more about that. And with that, just again, we have a number of different facilities in the state. They do use a number of different types of material. They all provide different types of benefits to the facilities that they are. And they all face different challenges and there's different opportunities. But that's what I had for you this morning, and I'm happy to answer any questions or provide any other information.
Okay. I have questions, but I'll wait and see if anybody, Representative Woodson.
What was the total amount of Betsy money that went to your bioenergy programs in the state?
It was about $175 million, but that's since the year 2000. I believe back in the 80s, 90s, there were some other incentives that were provided, so we can certainly give you a full accounting of that.
Could I follow up? Could you tell us also what is the total energy produced to date by that Betsy money, if you will? And I noticed some of the facilities are not operating, and I was wondering why they're no longer operating.
Sure. Chair Boone, Representative Woodson, we can try to get you information on the amount of energy that's been produced. And some of those data sets are more or less robust, but we'll get you what we can. As to the question of why some of those facilities are idle, as I mentioned, most of the facilities, especially in the wood energy side of things, are dependent upon the existing industrial process that's there. So if the mill's not producing lumber, there's not need for the energy that they could produce, and there's not necessarily the mill residuals or other types of materials as fuel. Other factors include low market prices for electricity, high cost of transporting and collecting the woody biomass, and the fact that some of the other benefits that we've mentioned are not recognized financially in the price of the material that they pay. So, you know, each facility is a little unique, but those are some of the challenges that we've heard from those facilities.
Just one last thing.
Okay.
In my district, we've had two... It's my understanding, two biomass facilities that have not been permitted by the Department of Energy in a timely fashion, and so the people lost their ability to get funding to build them. And I was wondering, maybe you could check and see why they weren't permitted in a timely fashion, because these are things that we could have really used in Klamath Falls and Lakeview, and this is what I heard, and I don't know if it's true, but that the government held up the permits on them, and the people didn't know why. So,
Chair Boone, Representative Witt, I don't work for the or staff the Facility Siting Council, so I can't speak directly to that, but I'd be happy to work with our staff back at the department to get you some summary of that.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Rep. Bence and then Rep. Leiniger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think each one of us would appreciate a measure of the value of these programs. And I know you went down through some of those values. They break down, though, into just a couple. One is the environmental value, and the other is some energy generation, but it's modest. The third, though, and the one that's very hard to measure, is the desire to subsidize communities that need jobs. Each one of those should have a measure on it, so that you could come in and say to us, this is the value of the tax credit. To say that it brings jobs to a community is extremely valuable in John Day. I mean, it's a big deal. But how do we measure it? And so that's something that I've struggled with in knowing. Politically, it's very important to me. I'm not sure how much value that has to Chair Boone. The point is, how do we measure it? And this, the reason I bring up John Day is that they have been given a forest stewardship program under the federal government. But the trouble is the woody biomass is too far from Malheur lumber to really make it worthwhile to haul all of that stuff that they're going to be trimming out. The one of the values that we're going to lose as a result of that is the improvement in the forest. Because the biomass piece is a huge part. How do we measure that? How do we go into anybody and say, you see what I'm saying? The biomass is a piece of it, all right, but the bigger issue would be the return to the forest because it's so dramatically improved as a result of this activity, but our little tax credit doesn't quite do the job.
Chair Boone, Representative Bence, thank you. We did do an economic impact assessment of the biomass tax credit program earlier that I'd be happy to send to the members of the committee. And the other attributes that you mentioned we can certainly look into as well. I think that the biomass part of these discussions is one piece of that broader picture that you're mentioning and can help contribute to some of those other forest management activities or economic activities. So we have been working very closely with the Department of Forestry to understand how the biomass aspects of these fit into the efforts that they have. So we can certainly work with them on.
So a follow-up, if I may. So the issue is, we know that if we decide to use these devices and justify them because they create jobs, that's a subsidy of some sort to the community that we're trying to create the jobs in. Well, if we've reached that point in the analysis, then why wouldn't we look a little bit further? Because all we're really doing is trying is funneling money into that community, utilizing this tax credit as the conduit. The real problem is jobs, and this is an inartful way of getting to them. So what I'm struggling for is a measure of that. Now we can use the study you've given us and work our way back into it, and perhaps the discussion would be better if we brought in the Economic Development Department and had them weigh in on this also, because I'm interested in understanding the component of the biomass that actually is just a subsidy for jobs, having nothing to do with any other part of it. So there's the challenge.
Yeah. Chair Boone, Representative, thank you. We're happy to accept challenges.
And if I may, that's a very good point you've made, and I think we should follow up on it. And in Andy, you're always the looking outside the box kind of guy. So, and I'm sure you are too, Matt. maybe you could look at working together with these guys over there to get that, because that's important. The jobs piece is important, and I get what you're saying, and having to have the whole discussion is tantamount. So, Rep. Leiniger?
Thank you. I have some similar questions to the ones that Representative Bence is mentioning, kind of on a larger portfolio level as to biomass, but also the other incentives that the state provides to support renewable energy facility flourishing around the state. And I think that in addition to jobs, additional benefits are things like energy independence, resilience, you know, air quality improvement when you're not burning slash, for example, but instead using that material more in a more clean way, demonstration value, market making, which I know you mentioned at the beginning was one of the initial reasons for the solar program. But it would be interesting, you know, for a new person, but as I think the state is thinking through how we best incentivize creation of renewable energy that makes sense, you know, from a jobs perspective, but economically, to have kind of an overall return on investment summary for how our investments as a state in renewable energy generation are doing. And so it would be interesting to see that from a biomass front, but also across a couple of the other domains. And in my view, you know, as to jobs, but also as to some of those other you know, maybe reduced operating costs. Do schools and public facilities and even small businesses that do these things have reduced operating costs? That's also an aspect of benefit, but it would be helpful to see where we are in a return on investment place on these different domains. It might be a project we could help encourage DOE to look into the future. And if you've already done it, and since I'm new, I don't know that, if you could please direct me to that, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, Representative Linger, that's a really important question. There's a difficult things to quantify. It's something that I'm very interested in as well. So we'll look into it and see if it's possible, how much this work has been done already, and see what we can get back to you with.
Great.
Thank you.
You know, and just on top of that, it made me think of some project I was looking at, not biomass, but a tidal project. In a little town near Halifax called Briar Island, they have what they call the community fund, and this is to assist in their funding of these programs. But the money, so you buy shares into it, into your town, so to speak, to make it simple. The money stays in there. The fund has to be spent locally. 51% has to be, you have to be a member of the community to buy. Like, you and I can't buy into it. Mm-hmm. We have to have somebody to give money to that they buy into it. And so that money then is used to facilitate the funding of some of these programs to as an incentive to move toward projects that will produce power, in this case, to their community. And they're kind of off the grid in that sense because they've produced their own. So when things happen, they've got some backups and they have the money to invest. But it all stays there. It's very popular, and you buy in for as little as $50. Mm-hmm. So something to look into. Any other questions of this panel?
Well, I want to ask your question, all because right. I heard this yesterday and I asked the question, but you didn't. What, could we use more of this type of facility on the coast because of the emergency preparedness aspects of it? I thought you were going to ask that.
I have a couple of questions, but, and actually you answered, I waited, I didn't want to interrupt you, but you answered one of them was what incentive programs you have for biomass now. But one of the other things you can add to your list up, that by not burning the slash, you also help prevent a forest fire, potential forest fire, and that's happened so much in a slash burn when the wind comes up, and then you have a real problem, and air quality too. So one of my questions was about the Energy Conservation Incentive Program. I'm not sure what that is. If somebody could just give me a brief summary of that.
Thank you, Chair Boone. The Energy Conservation Incentive Program was established as a new program to replace the Business Energy Tax Credit.
Okay. It's just that name. Okay. And then one thing you can add to your portfolio when you give, this is a great presentation, and I think you should do more of them around the state to let people know what we're doing in the state. But, and adding to your digester thing, this small farm thing where you need 1,000 cows, but not everybody has 1,000 cows, but your neighbors might have 300 or 400, and you can co-mingle, they have to be touching, but you can run lines from all of them and collect the manure and go to one digester, which will then power all those farms, and it gets rid of the, you know, raw manure, but it returns the compost, as you will. But in dairy land, we use it as bedding for the cows, so it's kind of a complete circle. You know, eat the grass, they poop, digest it, it comes back and start over again, and then the liquid goes on to the what's left goes on to the fields to grow the grass so they can start over again. And there was one other thing I wanted to ask you about. And it had to do with what Representative Benz was talking about. So his problem in that one case was the biomass stash was too far away from, you know, to make it. And that's the thing I'm hearing in my area in some places. Something like a 50-mile radius has to be to make it cost right. So is there any way in an area like Rep. Benz's that has, like, a million square miles in his district that you can give them some kind of different program aspect so they can expand that and give them some way to get that stuff to them or without having to build 20 different biomass digesters?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Boone. It's a tough question, and you hit on exactly the challenge, is that the material is bulky, got a lot of water, it's expensive to move, it's expensive to process, but it takes a lot of people to do it. So it does have some great opportunities to help keep people working. We would be able to take a look at how our existing program works and think about what that might be able to do for those types of facilities.
That would be great. We want to keep him happy. You know,
yeah.
Okay.
I just want to make a comment. Down in the National Forest in Lake County, U.S. Forest Service is charging $700 per load to haul forest products out of a forest that needs a lot of work on it. And that's their toll, if you will, to haul materials out of the area. I mean, this is a huge problem because you can never make back the value of what they're charging to haul each load of material out on the Forest Service roads. Mm-hmm. A lot of people aren't familiar with that, but
it's
not a good situation for the woody biomass.
Well, any other questions? No? Thank you, and I'm really glad to hear what's going on. And this truly is one of my favorite agencies, and had a little bit of a briefing yesterday on some other things your agency's doing, and despite your current challenges. But I really think we're making some progress, and appreciate your forthrightness, and hopefully you can come back and give us some more good news later on some of these. And in the meantime, working with this guy, this woman to help in their districts. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And while you're vacating, we'll call up the Hanford cleanup. Ken Niles. This PowerPoint. Yeah. All right. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Chair Boone, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Ken Niles. I'm the administrator of the Nuclear Safety Division of the Oregon Department of Energy. Appreciate the opportunity to give you a brief update on the Hanford nuclear site and what's been going on there. There's been a lot in the news lately, most of it not very good, and I do want to go through that. I've got a number of slides, like Matt, a lot of photos. I'll get through it fairly quickly. I did want to start with just a very brief little background on Hanford, just to give everybody a little bit of context for what Hanford is, as we've found that oftentimes people aren't fully understanding what it is. So the Hanford site it's a large site, geographically in southeastern Washington State, 586 square miles. From Oregon's perspective, the primary reason, not the only reason, but the primary reason that we're involved with Hanford is because the Columbia River flows through the Hanford site, and then obviously is very vital to Oregon. And when you look at the proximity of some of the facilities at Hanford, and you understand that, for example, this is a liquid waste disposal trench that they sent millions of gallons of contaminated liquids into, that and other similar trenches just right along the Columbia River. Hanford dates back to World War II, was part of the Manhattan Project to build a nuclear bomb. They produced plutonium at Hanford, and they were successful in doing that. They went through a number of expansions, some pretty substantial expansions of their facilities in the 1940s and 50s into the early 1960s. Overall, they produced plutonium for about 45 years and produced about two-thirds of the nation's plutonium. This was the final product at Hanford, the plutonium puck, which was then sent to a facility in Colorado that then further refined it for insertion into a nuclear weapon. The processes at Hanford to make that plutonium puck generated huge amounts of radioactive and chemically hazardous waste. This is a desert environment, but they created so much liquid waste, they estimated about 440 billion gallons of contaminated liquids, that, not surprisingly, they ended up with extensive contamination of the groundwater at the Hanford site. Also, huge amounts of solid waste, and they have burial grounds at Hanford that numbered in the hundreds. Some of the material, obviously, pretty radioactive that was deposited in those burial grounds. And then huge numbers of facilities and support facilities for the reactors. This is two of the reactors, the K East and K West reactors that were built in the 1950s. The largest reactors at Hanford, and again, you can see that's actually the same liquid waste disposal trench I showed you earlier from just a different perspective. By 1988, with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the breakup of the Soviet Union, and someone in the United States government determined that having enough plutonium for 32,000 nuclear weapons was probably sufficient, production at Hanford shut down. And not just at Hanford, but at Savannah River in South Carolina, which was a similar facility, and over 100 facilities around the nation that all were part of the nuclear weapons program. Under pressure, the Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Energy, which owns and operates Hanford, signed a cleanup agreement that just 2 weeks ago we passed the 25th anniversary. And the goal of that cleanup agreement was to bring Hanford into compliance with state and federal environmental laws. And at the beginning of the cleanup, 25 years ago, they anticipated about a 30-year cleanup program. Oh, if they had been right, we would be nearing completion. Unfortunately, we still have, in all likelihood, 40, 50, perhaps 60 years to go to complete cleanup in Hanford. So there's been a lot of news about Hanford, a lot lately about some of the problems, and I'm going to go into some detail about that. But there has been progress, and sometimes it's often overlooked. And I want to just review some of the significant progress that has occurred over this 25 years. A lot of it had to do with removing what were, at the beginning of cleanup, very immediate and very serious safety risks. So in this case, there was 2,100 metric tons of spent nuclear fuel stored in concrete basins, one of which had leaked extensively in the past, just a quarter mile from the Columbia River. So it was a very difficult process to determine the processes that they would need to dry this fuel, to remove it, to repackage it, to move it away from the Columbia River. It's still at Hanford, still radioactive, but it's now stored in a configuration that really is conducive to long-term safety. When they shut down the facilities at Hanford, they didn't do it in a real orderly way. And so they had a lot of plutonium and plutonium-bearing materials in chemical forms that really were not conducive to long-term storage. And so they went through a long process as well to stabilize that plutonium, and then were able to actually ship it off the site. It's now stored at Savannah Riverside in South Carolina. Cleanup involves a lot of treatment facilities and a enormous disposal facility in the middle of the Hanford site. This is an engineered landfill with a leachate collection system. Most of the debris from the building demolition, most of the contaminated soils are moved from the outer areas of the Hanford site into this inner core where they're buried and will be disposed of permanently. They have made great strides in the groundwater pump and treat systems. have gone from really containing and stopping most of the plumes from entering the Columbia River to now where they're actually actively cleaning up some of these plumes. There were 9 nuclear reactors that produced plutonium at Hanford. They have put 6 of them into what is called interim safe storage or cocooning, where basically they're just isolating the very highly radioactive reactor core. The plan is in 75 years or so, and who knows what will happen that length of time, but the plan is at that point the radioactivity would have decayed enough to allow dismantlement of those reactors and move them off the river, which our Native American partners at Hanford would love to see happen. 2 more to go in the cocooning. 1 will be preserved as a museum. They've demolished a huge number of contaminated buildings, some of them very highly contaminated, and dug up hundreds of millions of tons of waste from along the Columbia River. So this is a little different perspective of Hanford. So the gray area on the outer border was never really used as part of the plutonium production. It was more of a safety and security buffer. There were some military anti-aircraft facilities, some motor pools, things like that. That's all been cleaned up. During the Clinton administration, it was declared the Hanford Reach National Monument. It is managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but as yet really is not open for public use. At least the area north of the river is, the rest of the area is not. The green area they call the river corridor. It's where the cleanup is focused really for the most part during this past 25 years. Very early on in the process, stakeholders, including Oregon, said that is where you really need to begin the cleanup and focus and get those materials away from the river and keep others from entering the river. By the end of 2015, most of that green area, the surface cleanup in that area, will be completed. The pump and treat of the groundwater will continue for decades. The kind of the mustard area in the middle is what will be the permanent footprint of Hanford. That's the waste management area in perpetuity. That's where the processing canyons are. That's where the underground waste storage tanks are. That's where the huge landfill is. That area, and I'm going to show you an aerial photograph of that in just a moment, that will be permanent waste disposal area. The brown area that surrounds it is kind of the next target of cleanup. It is not nearly as heavily contaminated as the inner part, so that will not take a whole lot to do. I mentioned earlier there was huge amounts of waste, liquid waste, generated as part of the processes. There was one waste stream that was just so toxic they knew they would not be able to dispose of that to the soil, and they built underground storage tanks. And when those tanks filled up, they built more tanks. And when those filled up, they built more tanks. This is the biggest legacy of waste and the biggest challenge of cleanup that remains at Hanford. And I'm going to talk a lot more about this because there's a lot going on related to Hanford's tank waste. 56 million gallons is what we have at Hanford in 177 underground storage tanks. Most of those of a design that was just has a single shell of carbon steel embedded in concrete. 63 of those older tanks are known or suspected to have leaked over the years. One is actively leaking into the soil. 28 double shell tanks of a newer design, but still the newest of those is still 28 years old. A big deal in the past year and a half is that they recognize that one of those tanks is leaking from its inner shell into the outer shell. So that's it's really a big deal because it's going to take many decades to treat this waste. And there was, I think, a unfounded hope, but certainly the hope that these double shell tanks were going to have to continue to safely store this waste for decades to come. The fact that we've lost really the use of one tank already is very concerning for us. So here's that aerial view. You're looking west now. The areas, the 200 west area, the 200 east area, duplicative in a lot of senses, that both had processing canyons, both had a lot of underground waste storage tanks. You can see all the tank farms are marked there. the border between the 200 west area and the 200 east area is about 3.5 miles. So there's a good length of distance there. In the foreground, what's called the waste treatment plant, is a very expensive, very elaborate complex of facilities that are being constructed to immobilize this waste. As you look inside the tanks, you see a variety of different layers of sledges, of salt cakes, of liquids. Again, of that 56 million gallons, roughly about 30 million of it is of a liquid nature. The rest is of harder materials like this, all of which has to be retrieved from the tanks for treatment, which is a problem all in itself. And the working environment, certainly very hazardous for the tank farm workers. Just in the last few months, we had 28 tank farm workers seek medical help just because of vapor exposure from vapors coming out of these tanks. Six people yesterday just went to the hospital because of vapor exposure from the tanks. So it's ongoing safety issues for the workers. The tanks are clustered in what they call tank farms of anywhere from 2 to 16 tanks. This is a double-shell tank farm under construction. This is a virtually completed tank. All that they had to do was then bury it under dirt. And the dirt, about 10 or 12 feet of dirt, acts as a radiation barrier. And so it's necessary to keep these underground. But you can see all the protrusions from a tank, and the top of those pipes is where the ground level is. The leaking double shell tank, identified in October of 2012, not a huge amount by volume, but again, very concerning because it really does take that tank out of commission. And it brought a lot of scrutiny of the status of the other tanks, which was a good thing. This is the annulus before the tank began operating. So the inner shell on the right-hand side, the outer shell on the left. This area is way too highly radioactive for a person to get into. So what they do is they use cameras to look at the annulus. They also have some leak detection devices. But it was through use of one of the cameras and a routine search that identified some material in the annulus that should not have been there. And the third amount of waste just discovered about 2 months ago. So if you look at this million-gallon tank, which is about 45 feet tall and 75 feet in diameter, so a huge tank, if you look at it from the top down, there's a leak somewhere underneath the bottom of this tank, and there's waste that has come out in the 11 o'clock, the 1 o'clock, and the 7 o'clock positions. So there's enough waste that it's pushed at least 70 feet across that's coming out of this tank. Senator Wyden has been very actively involved in Hanford throughout his entire career, both in the House and Senate. He and his staff looked at some of the manufacturing records from the construction of these tanks. The tank that's been leaking was one of the first two double-shell tanks that was constructed at Hanford. They had significant construction problems with a weld failure rate of above 50%. That meant that all those welds had to be redone before they could put that tank into service. Senator Wyden's evaluation was that at least six other had similar problems. Another 13 have concerns, which means 20 of the 28 tanks have at least some issues. The Department of Energy's response is basically, we have greatly increased our scrutiny of these tanks. No additional ones are known to be leaking. What nobody disputes is that these tanks are old and getting older. You know, the waste that they're storing in some cases is very thermally hot, highly radioactive, highly caustic. So it's not a good environment for those tank walls. Under state RCRA laws, the Department of Energy was required to empty that leaking double-shell tank within 24 hours of its discovery or as soon as practical. State of Washington grew concerned that the Department of Energy was just basically monitoring the tank, had no immediate plans to empty it. Under pressure, the Department of Energy issued a tank retrieval or tank pumping plan in March of this year. They talk about a process to procure the necessary equipment to pump the sludge in that tank. They're looking at about 2 years away before they would even begin to authorize pumping of the tank. They're estimating about 20 months to pump that tank once they begin. The state of Washington did not like that answer, and so they issued an administrative order which required the Department of Energy to begin pumping the liquid waste September of this year, pumping the sludge next year, and completing pumping sufficient to determine what caused the leak by the early December in 2016. Not surprisingly, in April, the Department of Energy appealed that order, so that's currently going through the appeal process. It's not an easy job. There's about 150,000 gallons of sludge with 650,000 gallons of liquid. This sludge is among the highest heat sludge at Hanford. It does need some of that liquid on top to cool it and to prevent it from overheating. Department of Energy, because they can't just move that waste into any tank, and because the connections are a little bit different, their estimate is it will involve, to pump this tank, will involve at least 8 double shell tanks, 20 transfers of waste between tanks, and then they will create liquid to mobilize that, they will insert liquid to mobilize that sludge, and 3 campaigns of their evaporator to remove that excess liquid. So it is a complicated process. Treating the waste, really since the beginning of Hanford cleanup, there has been a vision of immobilizing the tank waste through a process called vitrification. And it's a proven technology. It's been used in 2 other sites in the United States, used in Europe as well. Unfortunately, at Hanford, the volume is so huge and the chemical complexity is so different that the facilities that they have to make to vitrify the waste are incredibly complex. And vitrification, what it means is basically mixing the waste with glass-making materials under heat to form a molten glass, which would then be poured into stainless steel canisters. It would still be radioactive when it hardens, but again, it would be out of the tanks, out of the near environment. It would be very easily to store safely for an extended period of time. When the Tri-Party Agreement was passed and approved in 1989, they envisioned at that time 10 years before vitrification would begin at Hanford, so 1999. We're still a number of years away. And after a few failed attempts, Department of Energy and its contractors are constructing what is now escalated to over a $12 billion group of facilities, again collectively called the waste treatment plant, would have a pretreatment plant which would separate the waste stream into a highly radioactive, low-volume stream and a low-activity, high-volume waste stream, also some balance of facility, support facilities, analytical laboratory. Here is what these facilities look like as of about a year ago, and it really hasn't changed much. You can see very different levels of completion on these facilities. The pretreatment facility, the high-level waste facility, are by far the most complex. They lost about 2 years in construction several years ago when the Department of Energy had to reevaluate its seismic standards, and so they stopped those construction of those, only to resume it and then stop again within the last year and a half because they have still not resolved some of the technical issues with these two facilities, especially the pretreatment facility, in terms of whether or not it will work as designed and whether it will work safely for the 25 or 30 or 40 years it would need to work. So right now the Department of Energy is struggling mightily. They have proposed a method to bypass the pretreatment facility and go directly with some waste to the low-activity vitrification facility, which could be operational within a couple of years, but that would require additional design and construction of in-tank farm pretreatment facilities. It's a little bit of a mess at the moment. As I mentioned, the schedules have slipped greatly. The original for this facility, which began construction 2001, was to begin hot operations in 2007. You can see that things have continued to slip. Currently, based on new litigation filed by the state of Washington, joined by the state of Oregon, in 2010 and then resolved in 2010. This is the current schedule. So the waste treatment plant, fully operational by 2022, all waste removed from the single shell tanks by 2040, and all waste vitrified by 2047. Within a year of signing this consent decree, the Department of Energy indicated that some of these milestones were at risk. Within 3 years, said all of the milestones are at risk, and there's another two dozen or so interim milestones in this. So the state of Washington began the dispute resolution process of this consent decree. In March of this year, their proposal was to give the Department of Energy a few more years for fully operational, so the facilities would be fully operational by 2028. I mentioned this direct feed option to the low-activity waste facility. Ecology is supportive of that. Department of Ecology of the State of Washington. They would like to see it online by 2019. They kept those two end dates of all waste retrieved by 2040, all waste vitrified by 2047. They're very concerned about the pace and progress and the condition of those tanks, and so they are now their proposal to the state, to the Department of Energy, was to construct at least 8 million gallons of new double shell tank capacity by 2024, depending on whether other things are delayed, potentially up to 20 million gallons of new tank capacity. Additional stabilization, which means pumping out some of the liquids of 24 of the single shell tanks, and additional accountability to the court so that a year after signing a new agreement, they don't find themselves in the same predicament. The Department of Energy found out that the state was going to issue this proposal on March 31st. They issued their own proposal, which had a phased approach to completing the waste treatment plant. This hot commissioning of the low-activity vitrification plant, which Ecology supports, by 2019, Department of Energy says would take at least three additional years. No other commitments on dates, no timelines, nothing at all in terms of when they would complete this mission. This also is entered a dispute resolution process. They are nearing the end of a 40-day period in which they can try and negotiate a new agreement. They've had three meetings, the third being yesterday. The first two meetings did not go all that well from what I've been told. Have not heard how yesterday's meeting went, but we fully expect that the state at some point will go back to the judge and say, this isn't working, we need the court's intercession. Money is a big issue at Hanford. The current budget is about $2.2 billion. They've spent about $40 billion so far on cleanup. When they look at the requirements for federal fiscal year 16, outside of all these tank problems I talked about, the needs are $3.7 billion to meet their compliance agreements on other parts of cleanup, and nobody anticipates that that will occur. With that, before I go to your questions, let me make just one last invitation. We are hosting a tour of the Hanford site on June 26th. Representative Reardon attended this tour last year, a similar tour. It is a long day. It is a fascinating day. It is an entire day commitment plus the time to get there the afternoon before. But if you're interested, please let me know or Robin Freeman of our agency, and we'd be happy to have you accompany us. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Ken. When I was 19 and started marching against this stuff, we were told, oh, just wait a few years. Everything will be fine. And it just completely flabbergasts me to see this. And I was there. I also cannot believe I did this, but I visited a uranium mine in Canada and went down into it and then went into the processing plant part and was just taken back how kind of loosey-goosey things were in there. And the high level of radiation and how long it lasts and how hard it is to clean up and finally how much money has been spent on it. And we really didn't use all that stuff that we made, thank God. Well,
it may.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think of how much, what this presentation says, how much plutonium we made and how, you know, and how viable, how volatile it is and how dangerous it is and how many people downriver have experienced problems, and not to mention animals and fish. So it's just, it's, you must just go crazy. So, Rep Burton.
Well, first of all, I would encourage anybody to take that tour. It's not going to make you feel any better, but it is fascinating. And Ken has used the terms of, you know, huge and big and tremendously complex. It is. It is just amazing, the challenges that are over there. And so I think you've answered most of the questions I had, but I think for the rest of the panel, could I suggest that you clarify the members of the Tri-Party Agreement and Oregon's role and how limited that is, and then also comment that we have a tremendous team that's working to help us as best they can. I'm so impressed with everybody, Ken and his team.
Thank you. Yes, Chair Boone and Representative Reardon. The Tri-Party Agreement, which is the cleanup document that oversees the Hanford cleanup, the three parties are the U.S. Department of Energy as the polluter and the State of Washington Department of Ecology and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency as the state and federal regulators. Oregon is not a party to the Tri-Party Agreement. We have extremely limited legal authority at Hanford. We are a trustee of natural resources under CERCLA. But otherwise, our influence is through, you know, sometimes we refer to it as the noisy neighbor when needed. Sometimes it's coming up with a different technical approach or proposal. We have looked at areas that we think we can be influential, and I think we have been on raising the profile of groundwater contamination. Because that really is the way in which Oregon would be impacted, is contaminated groundwater reaching the Columbia River and impacting the river. Radioactive material transportation safety, because we are really the corridor of getting waste to or from the Hanford site. Most of that travels through Northeast Oregon, through your area. And so we have had a very active program on radioactive material transportation. We do have a small group that works on Hanford. I have three technical staff, that an ecologist, a chemical engineer, and a hydrogeologist, and myself, and then we have two emergency planners. So it was described as a small but mighty team, and I kind of like that description.
What's it? I have a couple questions. What is the rate of groundwater movement toward the river, and is the unit it's moving from highly transmissive, or is it going by faults in the basalt?
Representative Boone, or Chair Boone, Representative Wood said, there's a lot of different factors. Some of the groundwater moves very quickly. Some of the groundwater moves tremendously slowly. When Hanford was operating, really from the start of the first reactor in 1944 through the shutdown of the eighth reactor in 1971, they were directly discharging extensive amounts of radioactive contamination directly to the river. When that last reactor was shut down in 1971, the levels in the river dropped dramatically. You can still find evidence in the deep sediments or in an old sturgeon of some of those releases from back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. What we see now is there are small amounts of very localized contamination that are reaching the Columbia River. They are detectable at the point of entry, not detectable within a few yards downstream because of the dilution factor. Surprisingly, one of the biggest concerns is not a radioactive material, but a chemical, hexavalent chromium, is upwelling. There was, for a long time, they thought that groundwater entered the river just within the first few feet of the river bank. What they found a few years ago is that groundwater, in some cases, upwelling into the middle of the river, right into the middle of salmon beds. And so hexavalent chromium containment and cleanup became a huge priority about a decade ago, and they used I don't know if it's millions of gallons. They use certainly hundreds of thousands of gallons of hexavalent chromium over the years, a lot of which was spilled to the soil. And just in recent years, I think last year we showed you a deep dig at one of the reactor areas where they went down as deep as 85 feet to get at a chromium source before it could continue to contaminate the groundwater. So we're seeing really positive results on containing the contaminated groundwater. The concern we have is that over these decades of dumping contaminants into the soil, there are huge amounts of contaminants still in the soil above the groundwater that over time would continue to move unless something is done about those.
Yeah. Could I have a follow-up?
Please, yeah.
Is this primarily cesium that's the hottest of what you have there of your radioactive materials? And I was wondering how changing the state from liquid to solid in the vitrification changes the radioactivity level.
Chair Boone, Representative, what's it? It really is the entire gamut of radioactive materials. Cesium is one of the big players, and certainly is an issue because of its high level radioactivity. It also does generate some heat. Vitrifying it does not change its radioactive properties at all. So, you know, cesium, which has a half-life of 30 years or so, it's going to have to be managed for 300 years or so for 10 half-lives. Technetium-99 is one of the radioactive materials, and iodine-129 that are much longer lived, that have half-lives in the hundreds of thousands of years, that are fairly mobile in the environment, that when you look at long-term impacts at Hanford are the bigger players.
Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So two questions. The first, what is the, so we can have something else to worry about late at night, what's the worst thing that could happen? Is it an earthquake? What is the worst thing that could happen given the delays that have, I mean, when the state of Washington steps in, they have concerns. What's at the top of that list?
Chair Boone, Representative Bentz, there are a few things, and actually the number of those immediate big threats has been reduced through cleanup. There is a storage basin, a concrete storage, or actually a metal-lined concrete storage basin that holds about 100 million curies of cesium and strontium that was extracted from the tanks several years ago. So that's about a third of the radioactivity on site that's concentrated in these basins. And there is a concern that because of the high radiation emitted from those capsules, that it has embrittled the concrete. And so that has been something that's just in the past year or so that's really been ramped up as a concern that was really identified by one of my staff and raised, that moving those capsules out of that basin into a dry storage, a passive storage, has been raised as one of the priorities of the Hanford site. But it'll be a few years before that happens. An earthquake could damage some of those underground storage tanks and potentially allow a pathway into the environment if there was enough of a collapse of one of those tanks. But there really wouldn't be any energy behind that to project that material any distance. But it would certainly cause a huge mess there.
The second question.
Go ahead, please.
Controlling the cost, given the inadequacy of the remedy, must be really interesting. If you sit and try to draft a contract to put a lid on something that doesn't necessarily have a clearly defined process. And I believe I recall, I actually heard about this when I was first appointed to the Water Resource Commission in 1988, and we were told it would be about 30 years and this would be complete. But writing up those contracts, is this now the courts involved? Is that going to prompt a more speedy process? Because the contractors, what's their enthusiasm for moving forward and getting this done? Who controls that?
Mm-hmm. Chair Boone, Representative Bentz, it is the U.S. Department of Energy that writes those contracts. Through the 25 years, they have changed the process a lot when they recognized that early on it wasn't a good structure for how they were doing it. I think there's still folks that would feel it's still not a great structure for doing that. The system is set up where there are bonuses for the contractor costs, the direct costs are reimbursed, and there are systems of bonuses based on performance. And it does amaze us when the contractor for the waste treatment plant gets a bonus. When you look at the fact that, you know, they may have accomplished a minor piece of it, but the bigger picture is just we're losing ground. I don't know what the court's involvement might do. I think everyone's a little bit leery about that. And it frankly is why the Department of Ecology for the state of Washington has been so reluctant over the years to use litigation as a motivator, because it gets complicated and drawn out and more expensive and very ugly sometimes. And so I think we'll see what happens.
Thank you.
So my question on that along those lines too, but a little bit different. You mentioned what a high rate of failure in some of the construction, and that just doesn't seem normal to me. And it seems like in this sector that it would be, they would have higher standards and bigger, you know, hammers if they screw up, basically. So can you comment on that maybe?
Yes, Chair Boone. I think one thing you need to do is look at Hanford a little bit in kind of two different time eras. One was during the production years,
yeah,
when the production of plutonium reigned supreme and had all the priority, and managing the waste was something that did not have adequate funding or any level of priority. You know, it was very much a production-focused complex. Since cleanup began and production ended, you know, certainly the 50% failure rate of welds that I talked about, I mean, that was back in the 1960s with the construction of those tanks. But still, as huge and complex a project as this is, they still do see failures of equipment, and, you know, they will order a tank and it will come in and they'll inspect it and it will not pass muster. There are still quality control issues that have to be dealt with.
Thank you. Are we ready to go? Thank you very much, Ken. And
thank you.
God bless you.
Thank you.
How many years have you been doing this, Ken? 25?
25.
Oh, wow. So we're going to go to, we're going to skip ahead a little bit because we have some people on the phone and they had a certain time they could be on the phone. So we're going to DEQ's evaluation of the South Deschutes County and North Klamath County Groundwater Protection Project Steering Committee recommendations. So Dick Peterson, John Huddle, Robert Ray, and then we'll have Robert Ray is, and John Blakinger will be on the phone.
I think, are you both on the line now?
Yes.
Perfect. Robert Ray, are you on there?
I'm on the line, yep.
Okay, perfect.
Okay. Welcome, virtually. So we'll let you go ahead and decide who's first or how you want to do this. Thank you, Dick.
You bet. Chair Boone, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, director of Oregon DEQ, and with me today is Eric Nigg, who is our water quality manager out of the Bend office. Eric will be here to answer any questions that I'm not able to answer around this issue, since he's been deeply involved in it. So pursuant to a note in the 2013-15 legislative budget, DEQ was directed to report back to the legislature on its evaluation of recommendations for the South Deschutes and North Klamath County Groundwater Protection Steering.
Hello?
Yes.
I can't hear anything.
Okay,
we're going to fix it. Hold on.
Yeah, and then if they can put their phones on mute, it will be also easier.
Yeah, she said if you can put your phones on mute, that'll help improve things. Thank you. Okay, why don't we do a test here?
Try it again.
Try it again, Dick. And then let me know if you can hear him now.
Dick Peterson here. Can you hear?
It's better. It's still a little faint, but I can hear the word.
Okay, you'll have to speak up then.
I will speak up. We were also directed to research how other states have conducted cost-benefit analysis of the cost of septic system upgrades and report on its finding and its plan for undertaking such evaluation for South Deschutes and North Klamath counties. So I'm here today to provide our reports on these matters as was directed by the legislature. First, I will discuss the South Deschutes, North Klamath groundwater concerns. Groundwater use for drinking water in the area of South Deschutes and North Klamath counties near Lapine has been experiencing increased concentration of pollutants for many years. These pollutants are largely related to discharges from residential on-site septic systems. There have been several attempts to solve the problem over the decades, but the expense of adequate treatment has proven a persistent challenge for homeowners in the area. DEQ established a steering committee of local residents in May of 2010 to study the issue related to groundwater protection and provide recommendations for appropriate protective actions. The South Deschutes, North Klamath Groundwater Protection Steering Committee provided a report and recommendation to DEQ in July of last year, 2013. After we carefully considered the committee's recommendations, we held a public meeting in December of 2013 to update the community on a path forward based on the recommendations provided by the committee. Some of the recommendations are directed towards DEQ, while others involve DEQ in supporting role or don't involve us at all. With review of those and reporting back to the committee and to the community, DEQ fully supports the committee's recommendations and believes they provide a viable path forward for the project area. While all the recommendations address groundwater protection in some way, some are more critical than others, and I want to highlight our efforts on three of the most important recommendations. The first one involves a need for the counties to get a Goal 11 exception from Oregon's Land Conservation and Development Commission in order to allow the extension and installation of a community sewer or community sewers in much of the project area. As you may know, community sewers are not currently allowed in much of the project area due to statewide planning goal aimed at limited sewer utilities outside of urban growth boundaries. In preliminary talks with DLCD and Deschutes County, we believe an exception to this goal is both viable and appropriate in this case. Both partners agree with this course of action, and we are assisting them in developing a formal request for that Goal 11 exception. If an exception is granted, Klamath County has also shown an interest in this type of solution. The second recommendation for the committee involves the establishment of a sanitary authority to oversee wastewater planning and control of the area. The sanitary authority would be eligible for many types of funding that is not available to individuals and the region as a whole, and could also facilitate borrowing and bonding for the necessary infrastructure. For those reasons and more, DEQ supports this recommendation, even though we do not have a key role in making it happen. The third critical recommendation for the committee made was asking DEQ to suspend for 5 years its requirement that new or replaced systems include expensive nitrogen-reducing technology. While this requirement was established to minimize public health risk, we believe a limited suspension of 5 years would not significantly increase public health risk, and that it is the best course of action to take while individuals and the agencies take steps forward to look at a wider, longer-term solution that would likely be more cost-effective and protective of groundwater. We are currently talking with the agency attorneys on steps we would need to take to accomplish a temporary suspension of this requirement. Now I want to address the question of regarding cost-benefit analysis of septic system upgrades.
Hold on, yes. Just 1 second.
You bet.
So for you on the phone, we're hearing quite a bit of background noise here. Can you check again and see that you're muted, please?
Yeah, I was muted.
Okay. Number two? Okay, well, just make sure you check again. It's hard for us. We're hearing a lot of background on it, so we'll try again. Right. Go ahead. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair Boone. Now I would like to address the question regarding cost-benefit analysis of septic system upgrades. We were asked to research the extent to which other states conduct a cost-benefit analysis that weighs the cost of proposed upgrades against environmental impacts and public health risks. To accomplish this, we sent a survey to 15 states that include questions about whether they considered cost when determining what types of repairs or upgrades are required for a system that does not meet current standards, whether a risk analysis is part of the process, and what type of financial assistance were available to low-income homeowners. We received approximately one dozen responses and followed this up with phone calls for clarification and additional information. DQ also compiled a wide-ranging list of potential funding sources that could be directed towards upgrades and infrastructure in the South Deschutes North Klamath project area. Our survey results indicate that Oregon operates very similar to other states. For the most part, the states that responded to do not consider the financial circumstances of the property owner, but rather rely on state laws dictating appropriate levels of environmental protection. The survey also shows that Oregon offers nearly all the same funding opportunities as other states, which includes funding for economically disadvantaged communities. This includes grants, low-interest loans, and principal forgiveness, though each of these come with their own specific requirements and guidelines. A complete set of survey results can be provided upon your request, if you would like. We understand that Mr. Huddle, who's here today, has been doing some his own research, which is great, on this topic, and we're certainly interested in hearing the results that he might have to share. In closing, we support the recommendations in groundwater protection committees and are encouraged by the progress being made and the constructive working relationship between the state and local agencies. We will continue working closely with Deschutes County on a Goal 11 exception and determine the most appropriate way to temporarily stop the routine determination requiring nitrogen-reducing systems in most of the project area. I want to thank you for the opportunity to update you and fulfilling our requirement that was in the budget note, and certainly would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. Director Peterson, and I want to say welcome to Representative Mike McClain. I'm sorry I didn't notice when you sat down, and then Beth let me know, and there you were. So,
thank you.
Thanks for coming. This is your district, I take it?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is my district, and I was the creator of the budget note, and I wanted to thank Co-Chair Peter Buckley for allowing me to put this budget note in here, and your indulgence for this time. And I just had a few comments with regards.
Please, go right ahead.
This clearly is an area of the state that needs the state intervention to be able to meet the shared goals that we all have, and making sure that there is a protection provided to the groundwater, along with a viable solution for the folks that live there. And I think we've come a long way, and I appreciate the good work of the Citizens Action Group, and John Huddle is here to share some of their thoughts, and I know some of the folks are here from the Lapine area in South Deschutes County. But I also appreciate the work of the Director Peterson and DEQ on this. One thing that I think we're all looking for here is transparency and communications from DEQ, and then that regulatory flexibility that takes into account the real-world conditions rather than seeking an unattainable ideal. And in this situation, I think we're actually getting to the point where we have a, if you will, the perpetual, you know, the bureaucracy that people feel run over by is actually not doing that here, and they're actually coming up with, I think, something that is very favorable. For an example, the rarely granted Goal 11 exception and their willingness to institute a 5-year moratorium on AT&T requirements is very helpful, and I appreciate DEQ's cooperation like that. We do have to, colleagues, look at funding mechanism to help the homeowners, especially low-income folks. More funding is needed than is available to help folks implement a system. We, if a sanitation district is implemented, South Deschutes County is going to need some financial assistance, just like we do in all other areas of the state under different circumstances. This is a goal that, while it may not be in Representative Smith Warner's district or Representative Widener's, or you know, it's clear it's in mine and in the same county as Representative Whitsitt. I think we all share a common goal of making sure groundwater is protected. And so in 2015, if the good people from District 55 send me back here, I will be asking all of you to support some increased funding mechanisms to assist the CAG group and the homeowners in finding ways to implement solutions during this five-year moratorium. What my hope is, and what I talked with the director, and I hope this committee in 2015 recognizes, is the moratorium gives us time to get solutions done. And this is not something that we want to kick down the road, so to speak, Madam Chair. We need to solve this. And I think if we solve this in South Deschutes County, it could be a model on how we solve it on some of the areas on the coast in Senator Johnson's district. I know she has concern about this. And in Madam Chair, your district, those of us who have areas where we have critical groundwater and we have a population without sanitation districts, we need we're going to need similar solutions. So one thing I'd like to conclude with is, though, I think the advocacy, Director Peterson, that you and DEQ will need to do to make sure that Deschutes County gets that Goal 11 exception is going to put you perhaps in the ire of some folks that may not understand the need for it. And I think we support from my colleagues here and you is going to be needed to see this through. Mm-hmm. And I know we can count on you. Mm-hmm. And I hope we can count on everyone on this committee. But thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to be here.
Well, thank you, Representative. And you weren't here when we discussed it. And this is, I'll talk to you offline about what we call a community fund. And it might be a good application for that. So I'll talk to you offline on that.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. And thanks for outlining this, because it is important. And, mm-hmm. you know, DEQ is one of my favorite agencies, just as much as energy. So. So any questions of Director Peterson before we move on to him? Mr. Huddle, welcome. Oh, here come the guests.
Are you ready for me?
What about... Oh, to this.
Okay. So we have a PowerPoint if you want to put that up.
Okay.
So... And I don't know how you'll have to stick the buttons on me unless there's a...
Look at this.
I have to switch around unless it's a wireless keyboard.
I should turn it down like that.
Okay.
Let's change voices.
We'll switch. The musical chair.
See, Director, look at you're so popular. You've attracted a class of kids. So, and while we're waiting for everybody to get settled, just welcome the kids to the class, and you're going to be next, so just sit quietly, and this will be interesting, too. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Chair Boone and members of the committee. This was put together at last minute. We had a team working on this. It wasn't just me. But unfortunately, some of the key team members have had some family emergencies. So back to me. A little on the background of the history. While the budget note really was not centered so much on just the Lapine Basin, The issue that has been going on there since at least the 1980s is about the Lafine Basin. And it's roughly 400 square miles if you don't exclude the forest land that interspaces the subdivisions. Most of it is about 15,000 platted lots, most before Senate Bill 100 was passed. Estimates of taxpayer money spent trying to address this issue is somewhere between $20 and $30 million. And there's been little to show for the money, which when we get a little further on, I think will help you understand some other issues. The data, this is the from the real estate well, or not the real estate wells, but the well drillers' logs for the basin. The mode, the most frequent depth is 40 feet. The medium or the middle depth is 45 feet. I think the range runs from 6 feet to 1,400 feet approximately for the depth of the wells, but most of them are very shallow. Depth to water, medium is about 27 feet. Static water depth is 19 feet. The real estate wells, the well tests, the median NO3 or the nitrogen in the overall was 0.35 milligrams per liter, which is quite low. There was a USGS model that was designed, and it was supposed to be the definitive model, but it's severely flawed, and I'll show you some of that in just a minute. The data collection that was done with that lacks some rigor and method. The key part of that that really stuck out to me, and I have a background in research design and methodology, was well 1227, which was mixed in with water wells. This was supposed to be a calibration well study that was compared to the model. It had the highest, but it was actually drilled at the end of a drain field. And so it was a punched well. And there's the actual well that was punched. It was part of the National Demonstration Project that was done there at the end of the 1999-2000.
And Mr. Huddle, sorry to interrupt you. The timing is such that you have, I know you have a few more slides and stuff, but we still need to hear from the people on the phone before, so there's about 5 minutes left.
Right.
Thank you.
So what I'm leading up to is public trust was eroded. And when you look at the amount of money that's been spent there, and people are aware of that, that really has been part of the problem. So the cost of estimated in year 2000 to sewer the entire basin was about $200 million. At that time, the idea was that they were going to come in with ATT, alternative treatment technology, that was going to be about $58 million. But the problem was that nobody figured out how they were going to pay for this. And they didn't even know if it was going to work well. And as you may hear later from somebody else, the ATTs actually are not working very well, at least the ones that are approved. A lot of negative publicity. If you look at the report, the businesses in the Lapine area trended down sharply, the number of businesses, a year before the rest of the Deschutes County communities and a year before the recession hit. So there was a negative impact. What CAG did is we surveyed all 50 states and the Canadian provinces. We got about a response rate of about 22%. One of the problems we had was we got more responses than we showed, but as far as what other states were doing to help disaffected or disadvantaged homeowners, was there's only three responded to that. New Hampshire allows permit waivers and subsidies. Massachusetts has programs in place for repair and replacement. South Dakota only has a program in place for sewer upgrades if we connect to a sewer. What we did from there is we went on and looked at the EPA Clean Water portal, looking at what was states were doing through that avenue. We found 18% or 18 states or 36% actually have a program in place to assist individual homeowners, and those range from low interest loans to grants. 40% are using a private lender backed by the state. 30% are requiring a homeowner match to the grant or loan. That could range from 25% to 75%. Access to funds, 40% make direct Program access, 10% use lenders as a program gatekeeper, 30% required a local government entity to act as gatekeeper, 20% use some combination of local government or nonprofit entities. The funds were used either from repair or installation of new systems. Interest rates were very low, ranging from 1 to 3.75%. The funds used were the EPA 322, the Clean Water Fund, or the 319 program, which is a non-point pollution reduction program, or they used a combination, including state bonds and other funding. The recommendations, what CAG has looked at, is restore credibility is the first problem. Provide flexible solutions that are not perfection bound. Utilize a municipality or multiplicity of financial assistance and step up the education process on how to take care of your septic system. So under restore credibility, one of the key problems and one of the problems all along is we don't have the data to really support anything because the data collection, the monitoring wells have not been laid out in a method that is rigorous. So we don't know for a lot of areas. You're guessing, or you're relying on real estate data that can be imperfectly collected. So we need a rigorously designed program. We need transparency with the public. We need flexible solutions. Looking at grandfathering existing systems, that's kind of the New Jersey model. Some other states use that with a robust repair program. Let's get those steel tanks out of the ground. Let's extend leach fields. Let's do some things that are common sense. Use a range of septic solutions. Large parts of the world are using ATTs, but they're far less costly than what we're using. And they're reportedly very effective with very low effluent pollution rates. Follow other states' models. Look at New Jersey, sewer for new subdivisions and standard for others. So look at, you know, a combination or a tiered approach. Iowa has a flexible approach all the way through. One of the things is, modernize and upgrade existing statues. One of the things we see is a financial issue because there's some cumbersomeness as far as low income and disabilities. Set fees on a sliding scale. If you're being charged nearly $500 in a repair fee to replace a septic tank, and the tank might cost you $1,500, that's a very exorbitant fee for the same for the procedure. Let's get those reduced where it's needed. Has some flexible funding. Iowa has uses direct lenders, so if you go to your lender and they take deposits from the state, the lender makes the loans or the grants. So there's various flexibilities that can be built in, and clearly publicize all the options to the public. And then lastly, a lot of states are using their agriculture college, their ag school, to do the educating. They already got the program. I think OSU has already got the material. Let's turn that over to them and start educating people on don't drive over your leach field, don't put your water well too close because some of that isn't as tightly regulated as the septic systems. So, any questions?
Thank you very much. I think what we're going to do is go straight to the phone. So if you want to wait up there,
all right,
in case there are questions for you, too. So we'll go to you on the phone. Robert Ray and John Blekinger. Take it away.
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, and you need to identify yourself for our record. Thank you.
Okay. Robert, are you there?
I am here.
Okay. This is John Blekinger. I'm going to give a little background of what the committee did. So nitrates were first detected in the area in 1973, and since that time, there's been a number of studies done, a lot of money spent on scientific studies, demonstration projects for on-site systems. There's been sewer systems installed in the area, including what is now the city of Lapine. In 2008, the county passed an ordinance, Deschutes County passed an ordinance requiring ATT systems, and then the year later, the voters overturned that. which was a good thing because while AT&T systems cost a lot of money, they really do not adequately protect the groundwater in densely populated neighborhoods because they still discharge contaminants. The DEQ formed this committee in the fall of 2010. They interviewed 24 folks, selected 14, and after 3 years of meeting, we had over 40 meetings. We had 9 committee members, one of which had joined the committee in year 2. So the committee met with a lot of people, hydrologists, soil engineer, people from Oregon Health Authority, DLCD, and many solution providers. We analyzed the well test data, and we created maps that demonstrate where elevated nitrates have been detected. We had public comment at all our meetings. We did outreach in last year, and we had about 200 people, over 200 people, show up for our outreach meetings, which involved presenting what we learned, answering questions, and listening to the concerns of the attendees. And through all that 3 years, the conclusion of the committee is that there are unique characteristics in the area, which include shallow groundwater, sandy pumice soil, and neighborhoods with small lot sizes. Over 50% of the lots in the area, there's 14,000 lots, are 1 acre or less. So due to all that, there's an emerging problem with on-site septic systems contaminating the groundwater. And we measure the nitrates. While nitrates, there's some question of how much a problem nitrates are, but nitrates indicate a partially treated sewage, and partially treated sewage has all kinds of things in it, phosphates and pharmaceuticals and household products. So based on this conclusion, we developed the 10 recommendations that Robert is now going to talk about. Go ahead, Robert.
Morning. So the committee did come up with 10 recommendations, and 4 of them really stand out as ones that we really need to address initially. So the Goal 11 exception. So the area had platted lots prior to the creation of the planning goals, and we were just caught in that nexus of those goals, and many of the lots are already developed, and they were already platted prior to the planning goal. So the Goal 11 exception, where you're preventing the creation of a sewer district, and the connection of 2 houses constitutes a sewer district, so it really is putting a hamper on being able to treat the nitrates and I think the other pollutants that are going to be a more important problem than the nitrates. The groundwater monitoring is the second recommendation, and though the USGS study had a lot of test wells, it has to be now focused on the particular neighborhoods to see where there is an issue. In my particular neighborhood, after the study, it was determined that we didn't need to have the ATT systems. So in my neighborhood, you can actually install a standard septic system, one of the few areas in the South County that you can do that. But it still doesn't prevent me from wanting to see the rest of the South County do something to prevent the contamination of the groundwater. Some type of governance entity. So since the area is so large, perhaps a sanitary authority, I think that this needs to be explored, sanitary authority and individual sewer districts for the particular neighborhoods. And again, like I said, the connection of 2 houses together, which would be much more affordable in some cases, is prevented. We're prevented from doing that because of the goals. So some type of governance entity where it's a sanitary authority and sewer districts are contained within that authority. It's something that we think is probably going to speed things along. Livestock issues, that has been addressed by Deschutes County. They've, in their South County plan, they've addressed that. Point source contamination, so golf courses, we have several in the area. And at this point, they're self-monitored. We really don't know what's happening on those golf courses. So commercial RV parks in the county's initial local rule plan, commercial properties wouldn't have had to put in ATT systems. They weren't required as individual residents were. So a look at point source contamination is something that we need to look at. The ATT moratorium. So I think the moratorium would help the creation of and allow neighborhoods to create their sewer districts, but I think there has to be teeth in it. There has to be some evidence of forward movement. We can't just sit on our laurels and wait for the 5 years and then say, now what, we're going to be right in the same position we are right now. So some type of moratorium with a care and a bat. Disadvantaged community financing solutions, that's something that Mr. Huddle has mentioned and he and the CAG group have worked extensively on. Outreach, I think that we've all heard, educating the people down here on how to take care of their septic systems, again, something that Mr. Huddle referred to. Green solutions, I was a big proponent of green solutions, but I think that maybe only 1% would take advantage of it, and of that 1%, a small portion would take of it correctly. But green solutions actually, if you're talking about best available technology, they treat better than the ATT system that the county had recommended. You can start a fire with a laser, but you can at least start it with a match. There's actually no nitrate pollution with the composting toilets, and now with the DEQ's allowance of gray water irrigation in some areas and for vacation homes, it would be a viable alternative. But those are our recommendations that we came up with, and there are four that are really important: the groundwater monitoring, the goal 11 exception, the governance entity, and the moratorium. So those four, I think, are most important of the 10.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ray and Mr. Blakinger. And now I will entertain questions. So stay on the phone, please, for now. Any questions? Or questions of Mr. Huddle?
I have one.
Okay, Representative, what's it?
What are we looking at as the total cost for each home owner or each property to install or bring up to code so that you don't run into the nitrate problem?
Well, if we went with, thank you, Representative Whitsitt and Chair Boone, if we went with the current approved ATT systems, it's my understanding the average cost to retrograde is about $18,000. Now, that doesn't include annual maintenance costs, which can be expensive, plus permitting for the annual permit fee and having it monitored. It depends on the system, but the most general figure I've heard to upgrades,
$18,000. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative McLean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to again thank Mr. Huddle and Mr. Ray and Mr. Blackinger for their work. And colleagues, I think you heard from the folks who live there. And for me, this we have a moratorium, and we need to get a Goal 11 exception, and then we need to come up with some additional funding sources to get this thing accomplished. And I hope the members of this committee, having been briefed, will be supportive of that effort. And I know we can get this done, and it will be something that I believe will be duplicated in the other areas of the state that are similarly situated. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Huddle. And thank you, Mr. Ray and Mr. Ray and Mr. Blakinger. And we appreciate your input, and we'll look forward to working with you in solving this problem.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
Been waiting so patiently. Our next panel, we have three panels, but we're going to have, we have 10 kids, I think, today from Sunnyside Environmental School, and it looks like you have props with you. And I just have to preface this, and while you can, the first panel can come up, it's Michelle Strobel, who's the teacher, and we'll ask you to stay here, so we put an extra chair, mm-hmm. And David Williams from Cortland Public Schools. And just as a precursor to this, what you're doing today, kids, was done similar, was done by a little bit older kids, one being the daughter of one of the representatives at the time from West Lynn area. And even though crustaceans don't come from West Lynn, they come from my end of the world. But these kids came up with an idea to create a state crustacean, which is like a crab or whatever. And a thing, crustaceans are crabs, lobsters, and stuff. We don't have lobsters in Oregon, so we held it at crabs. And we have state trees, state nuts, state everything. And I won't tell you who the state nut is because it's always changing. But I'm just kidding. It's a hazelnut. And so they went forward with the whole bill-making process that I think you've been outlined on. And so if you should decide to do this, we're here and stand at the ready to help you. And you may become the authors of a new law. So with that said, we'll go ahead and let you start.
Okay. I guess I'll say I'm Michelle. Thank you, by the way, for having us here. I'm Michelle Strobel. I teach first and second grade at Sunnyside Environmental School in Portland. And this whole ban on polystyrene lunch trays came about a year ago when I was reading a book for Earth Day, a harmless book that talked about how much garbage was thrown into the ocean. And the kids were amazed at that. And it just got a conversation started. And somebody had mentioned that a school that they knew, the kids used polystyrene trays that got stacked up and just thrown away. And it was like shock going through our classroom because the kids in our school have never known polystyrene trays. They've only known plastic, reusable, washable trays. So they thought it was really bad that people would add to the landfill. And so we went to a city council meeting last year and shared it with city council, who loved our idea. Then we got back together and they started asking questions about polystyrene, and we started researching it, and we found out just like all these reasons why polystyrene is bad for our health, for our environment, and that we shouldn't be using it to feed children lunch. So that's kind of our background.
Thank you, Chair Boone, members of the committee. David Williams, Director of Government Relations for Portland Public Schools. And I'll keep this brief because I know I'm absolutely not the main event here. Just a couple of things about PPS and how we've tackled this issue with the district, and then we'll let the kids come up and talk. Real quickly, PPS is one of the largest food service providers in the city of Portland. We serve 11,000 breakfasts, 21,000 lunches, and 1,800 suppers. 32% of our food is locally sourced, which is probably three times higher than any other urban school district in the country. We've been very aggressive about tackling issues that are very important to Portlanders. What have we done in Portland when it comes to the ways we serve our food and what we serve it on? We've began about 5 years ago completely phasing out, both eliminating wholesale polystyrene trays, but as well beginning to phase out other disposable trays, because it's not just about the impact of what's in the tray, but it is about reuse of product and waste in schools. However, it's not without cost. So there's sort of two options that we've addressed in the district to do this. The first is to find some sort of alternative tray, right? Some sort of alternative disposable tray on which to serve the food. And hence you have sort of a compostable cardboard. You've all seen these sort of hard cardboard type trays. And we use those throughout the district. The other is to use a reusable hard plastic tray. And I think even there's a prop with us today on that as well. Those, again, are not without their consequence. So to go to the reusable washable trays, which we've almost universally implemented in our elementary and K-8s across the district, you have to make sure that you have a kitchen that can wash these and sanitize them for food safety standards. It's about $50,000 to retrofit a kitchen that doesn't already have sufficient work in it. This isn't just going down to Sears and buying a dishwasher. This is about a $10,000 dishwasher, and you have to have enough capacity and space to allow the trays to dry so you don't have buildup of mildew and mold. And then there's a staffing cost incurred with washing those as well. Again, we've implemented that almost universally in our elementaries. There are a few schools where the facilities simply cannot accommodate that kind of retrofit and upgrade, so we use the compostable trays there. Then we get to middle school and high school. Well, middle schoolers and high schoolers in particular, you know, kids are a little bit fickle with where and when they, how they eat their food. And sometimes these trays tend to walk off. So pretty much throughout our high schools, we simply do the compostable trays in our high schools and middle schools. Kids don't eat traditionally in a cafeteria setting. And again, high schoolers are wonderful people, but sometimes they find alternative uses for the reusable trays. So that's the process we do. One other really interesting development that could help spur this as well is that we know there are districts larger than PPS in the country, shocking though it may be. New York City and LA Unified have been working to develop a more cost-effective compostable tray. So, for instance, a polystyrene tray is about 3 cents for the tray. Obviously, that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're totaling up 21,000 meals every day, it gets to be a lot. A compostable tray, on the other hand, is about double. It's about 6 cents for the compostable tray. So you're nearly doubling your cost by going to a compostable tray over the polystyrene. New York City and LA Unified are working to develop a much cheaper compostable tray, and obviously that market base. So we have 48,000 kids in PPS. New York City has 1.1 million students daily in the New York City public schools. So clearly there's an economy of scale that we're really hoping that they can leverage to come up with a really good cost-effective tray as well that will help get out to other districts. Again, bottom line, PPS, we've done this. We've tackled this problem. We've found alternative ways to deliver our food in PPS that doesn't involve those polystyrene trays. But it has not been certainly without some cost consequences to it as well. But it's been a priority for us in the district.
Thank you. Any questions for David before he gives up his chair?
Again. How about creating a new business in Oregon where we actually, the state or the governor's solutions for helping to create jobs, use some of our forest products to create these compostable trays? Maybe that would be a really great thing for you guys to push to your representatives
and then use them for biomass.
Yeah.
Just fire the biomass burner to power the schools.
Absolutely.
Okay, anybody else? No? Okay, thanks. Thank you, David. Okay, our first panel is going to be Sam, Evan,
Finnan,
and Wednesday. And welcome to the House Energy and Environment Committee. So, before you start, this is the rule. When you talk, you just first you have to introduce yourself, and you can say who you are. We're going to know that Wednesday is not one of the boys, just because we know. But you still have to say your name too. So if you would, and if you don't mind, if I take your picture, if that's okay. Okay. And so, please go ahead.
Okay. Do you want me to introduce them as well?
Either way, and so because when they—that's how we do it. Because
they
it's
have
on
to do it themselves.
Tape, and also you're on the internet, and just to increase your stress level, I'll tell you this is being broadcast all over the world. So. But you guys look great today. You look
do the tie.
You look just perfect. So you can say whatever you like, and tell me what you have. Tell us what you have to say.
Hello, I'm Sam, and this is Finian. We are from SES, and I am here to talk about why some schools still use polystyrene trays. It keeps things that are warm, warm, and things that are cold, cold. It guards leaks, it keeps its shape, and it does not cost that much. It's sanitary, and it keeps your food fresh. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am Wednesday Peck. I am a third grader at Sunnyside Environmental School in Portland, Oregon. Today I'm going to talk about why polystyrene is bad for our health. When kids use polystyrene trays, the chemicals in the trays leak into the food, and when you eat the chemical, it can lead to cancer. According to the EPA, styrene, the chemical in those trays, can cause eye irritation, stomach problems, and headaches. Thank you.
Thank you, Wednesday. Dinner? Are you the one?
No, I'm not speaking.
He's not. Can you just pull it up just a little bit more so we can see them? Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Oh, wow. That is very, little agitators in the making. I love it. we had that discussion earlier. All right. What am I missing here? Oh, okay. So, okay. Well, thank you. You want to give up your chairs now to our next panel. And we have Lila, Dante, and Atelier. And I bet we know who Dante is, too. Anytime you're ready.
I'm Lila Scott. I go to Sunnyside Environmental School. I'm here to say why polystyrene trays are bad for the environment. One reason is it takes more than 1 million years to decompose. Polystyrene will be around forever. Polystyrene is lightweight. It means it floats. There are lots of polystyrene along the coasts and waterways around the world. It is now considered the main ingredient of marine debris. Polystyrene can kill animals that eat it. Birds eat it from the landfills and it fills their bellies. And when they don't get the nutrients they need to live. There are fewer and fewer places that recycle polystyrene. School lunch trays end up in the landfill. Polystyrene is a petroleum-based product. Petroleum production causes heavy pollution. All this for a tray that's only used once for only about 20 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Dante Acevedo. I am from SES. I'm here to talk about how we got our information on polystyrene in the schools. Michelle Strummel emailed 163 school districts in Oregon. Over 89 didn't reply and 49 used alternatives to polystyrene, but 17 used polystyrene trays. That sounds like a small number, but it adds up. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Akila Kelly. I'm a third grader at Sunnyside Environmental School. I'm here to talk to you about the numbers of how many polystyrene trays are used every day and year. Of those 17 districts that use polystyrene, that means 4,325 are used every day. Out of all the schools that got back to us, and in a week, 21,625 are used. In 1 year, 713,625 trays are used. If all the trays used up were stacked up, it would be taller than 15 space needles. That's a lot.
Wow, that's a great visual. That is. So I forgot to ask if there were any questions of the first panel, and if there are, we'll bring you back up. But so before you guys leave, and I wanted to say, you're absolutely right. I live at the coast, and occasionally I walk on the beach when I get time, which is really sad because, you know, when you live there, you should be able to be there. But that's another discussion. And we do see a lot of it on the beach. And what it does is it breaks down and it gets, like just like you said, little pieces, and the fish and the birds eat it. And we actually have a marine debris program, and kind of started up into being more of a tsunami debris, but we're seeing much more of this. So thank you guys very much. And any questions for this panel? Okay, so we'll go to our third panel. And that is Elliot, Naomi, and Sonia. And Elliot, you have to do extra good work because your mom's here. Okay, sad and good. Very clear. I like that.
Hello, my name is Ellie. I am a second grader at Sunnyside School. I am here to tell you about what we use at Sunnyside. We use reusable plastic trays because we think reusable trays are the most environmentally friendly choice because we reuse them and it reduces garbage and saves money. Thank you for letting me speak.
My name is Naomi, and I go to child's work, and we use... At my school, we use plastic trays or ceramic bowls or ceramic plates. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sonia Smith-Catacor. I am a third grader at Sunnyside Environmental School. I will talk about all the alternatives. We found that there are plenty of simple alternatives. One thing is a plastic tray. They are very strong and easy to clean. Plastic trays are reusable, so you don't have to buy them again and again. If you are looking for light trays, you can use cardboard trays. Cardboard trays are compostable. They are good for the environment. Thank you.
Thank you. And when I went to school at your age, compostable? We used ceramic, and so that was always such a, when they break, because kids always love to kind of break them. And it was always a big moment. But we didn't think about this in those days. And, you know, we didn't even do recycling in those days, except once we got the bottle bill, we could take our bottles back and things like that. So you kids are doing great. This is really uplifting for me to have you here today. I'm not always the chair. I'm usually the vice chair, but our chair is off being a county commissioner now. So he's actually probably your county commissioner. I'm not sure where. No, he's...
Jewel.
He is, yeah, okay. But thank you for doing this. And before anybody leaves, are there any questions for this panel?
I'd just like to say that what a great job you guys did. I have a third grader myself, and I would be thrilled if she did as good of a job researching and presenting that information as you guys did. So I just want to tell you what a nice job that is. And I know, I'm sure I'm speaking for everybody on the panel, when we would be very interested in talking to you about whether there might be some legislative ideas that you have about something maybe this body could do about this in the next session. So I look forward to talking more with all of you guys about that. And thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
Yeah. I just wanted to comment on the quality of the presentation, because it was, well, you're a little cuter than most presenters, but it was clear, it was very accurate, and it was concise, meaning it was short, to the point, and you didn't waste a lot of our time, which I really appreciate. So thank you very much, and those in the audience that are listening, please.
Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully those guys who are before you are listening back there.
And Rep Witchett?
I just want to commend you on your ability to read. That's really, really wonderful that you can read and write those words and understand some of those really giant syllable compound words there. So wonderful.
Rep Leininger.
What a great job. I'm the mom of a sixth grader, and I tell you, you folks presented along par, you know, right up there with sixth grade people. I would love to ask the chair if you might consider, if there are any grown-ups here who were dying to get a picture of their kids from the dais facing that way. I mean, I just have this spectacular view of all you people. If it were appropriate, I think it'd be really cool.
Absolutely.
If some of the grown-ups who are here might be able to take a photo this direction.
You're very welcome to come up and do so. And I have to... Look out, here comes your mom. So, yeah.
Could we have them all stand at the...
Oh, that's
nice.
That's a good idea. Do it that way. And while we're waiting for people to get settled, I have to call out Naomi. She was the one who brought the assistant. I thought that was pretty cool. Naomi's going places.
Her big brother.
Her big brother?
Yeah.
All right. So, Naomi, I think that's very smart of you to bring your big brother as an assistant.
Oh, yeah. The visual aid.
And you're a little bit younger, so you did a fabulous job, too. Everybody did a great job. And I actually think we should do this. I think we should do this. And you guys are going to progress, to fourth grade next year? And but you'll still be in third grade when we get into session. So
we're first through third grade.
First through third, okay.
Up from second grade.
And here's the carrot. It's another day out of school. So, but it's very instructive. So, as a mom who took my kids out of school often.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I do have two bills I want them to carry for me.
Okay. I think you need to work with them.
It works.
Yeah. No, this has been, and I forgot your name, Michelle.
Michelle,
yeah. If you had anything more to add.
I just wanted to say, you know, part of the problems, we had a handful of districts that were using polystyrene that really wanted an alternative, and cost was one of the problems, because even though he said it was double the cost, double the cost is different if it's 10 cents as opposed to 3 cents. So it's an extra 3 cents per lunch, which is really not that much of a cost, I don't think. And some people were talking about hiring somebody, but at our school, we use kids to wash.
To wash?
So you get service. Well,
doing better.
Service, you know, for helping.
Absolutely.
That's
fabulous.
They line up, they eat their lunch too fast.
What time's lunch, you guys?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Widener.
We used to actually have to do dishes as well as the upperclassmen, but like 7th and 8th grade, you'd be scheduled to work in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have one day a week or whatever, and The trays would come back, you'd have one rinsing them and the other one's running through the washer.
Squirting your friends.
The dishwasher is like the most popular
dish. A bit, yeah. Ruth Leininger.
I wanted to note, and one of the wise parents who's here today also mentioned this, that, you know, this wonderful teacher has created a learning opportunity for the students that will probably frame what you do going forward. And you're a testament to the great teachers we have working on behalf of us and our kids in Oregon. So thanks for your service.
Thank you.
We can do that here. So does anybody have a burning desire to say anything else while you're all up there? Do you want to work with us on getting this as a bill that would go statewide?
Yes.
And sometimes there's an opportunity to do a pilot project or something like that, but I think this is a great idea. So thank you very much, all of you, for coming down, and thanks to your families who did such a good job of raising them so far. You know. Very polite kids. I think you're all going to be stars.
Go ahead, Chair. Anybody who took pictures, could they give it to the other members of the committee?
Oh, yeah.
That'd be nice.
We will. We'll
send them to me.
We can all send our pictures to our Beth Riley, and then she'll disseminate them.
Yeah. The newsletters.
Thanks again. And Tara, thank you for helping out. Okay. Thank you for being so patient. We have on-site septic program, Mark Nystrom and Palmer Mason.
Thank you
for being so patient. I know we had to take you out of order.
And good luck following them.
Yeah, good luck following this guys. Well, they're kind of young guys, too. This is just the next step up. So.
Clear, concise, and cute.
Clear, concise, and cute.
And very persuasive.
And persuasive.
Cute's going to be tough, but clear and concise is good.
Yeah.
I actually wrote that down. Be concise.
Be concise.
You'd be okay if they came back and gave
it. It might help. Huh?
I think that was great.
Chair Boone, members of the committee, I'm Mark Nystrom. I work for the Association of Oregon Counties. I handle the energy, environment, and land use portfolio. Palmer and I wanted to let you know why we're here. So I'm going to give you a little bit of history of the on-site septic budget note work group. Counties ended up having some issues out in the rural counties with oversight of the on-site system program. So Judge Grassley and Commissioner Kestner from Lake County and Harney County asked the Government Efficiency Task Force in 2011 to address the issue that they're having a difficult time finding qualified staff to do their inspections, pre-cover inspections. So the Government Efficiency Task Force worked together and in 2012 came up with a couple of recommendations that private contractors perform the duties of DEQ's on-site septic program. We're going to give you an overview of this, the program in a second here, and that certified environmental health technicians perform limited duties. This created two House bills in the 2013 legislative session. Both of those bills died. Actually, because we felt like they needed a little bit more work, a little more input from the environmental health specialists and the wastewater specialists. So AOC requested that, so that this issue didn't go away, that a budget note would be added to DEQ's budget. So that's where we are today. And Palmer's going to provide an overview of what DEQ does with the on-site program.
And so for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Department of Environmental Quality. Before I start on this slide and kind of give you an idea of what DEQ does around on-site septic tank program, I did want to sort of maybe frame the overarching issue here is that DEQ and the counties have a partnership with the on-site septic tank program, and I'll go into that in more detail. And the question, I think, the real policy question is, moving forward, how do we figure out how to make the current system more effective, both for the state in terms of protecting groundwater and water resources, as well as protecting public health, and for the counties where they, at their discretion, at their option, take over the work of actually inspecting and permitting septic systems. So that, I think that's kind of the overarching issue that we're going to do. Mark's going to talk in more detail, is this partnership that we have with the counties. So what DEQ does is we have general oversight for the program, and in that responsibility, we license people to do work for pumping out septic systems and portable toilets, as well as license and certify people who install and maintain systems. We work with manufacturers on approving products that are used to manage septic waste from households and businesses. So we're looking at approving septic tanks and other alternative treatment options before they can be sold in Oregon and used in Oregon. We have work where we do response to complaints. Someone may have a system that's not been properly permitted, a system that may be failing. There may be questions of whether the right personnel, the right trained personnel, did the work in either installing the system or maintaining the system. We work on those issues under the complaint and response. That fourth bullet there of reporting on septic systems, a number of systems require ongoing maintenance once they've been installed, and those type of systems have to be inspected by the right people on an annual basis, and then there are reports that are filed with the county and DEQ about the viability of those systems. So that's what we're that's what we're covering there in the reporting. Then this next bullet there, which is actually misnumbered now that I see it, it actually should be five.
It's a bad number in a way. Yeah.
I'm a lawyer. I can't do math. So now you have proof of it. Yeah. So the general policy and oversight role that DEQ has. So in that work, we are undertaking rulemaking to set out where systems can be set up, the type of systems that can be set up, doing general guidance to the counties whom we have a partnership with, doing work with the vendors who provide the equipment that is used to manage septic waste, as well as the vendors and contractors who provide the installation and maintenance work. And then the last and most important thing there is the siting and permitting of systems. And the basic issues there are looking at the soils and finding and determining whether the soils are suitable for a system. And then once you've crossed that question, looking at the second major question, which is based on those soils and the type of business or household that you're looking to service, what type of system is best suited for that? So those are the permitting questions that we are involved in. And Mark will elaborate on that more, where there are cases where DEQ actually does the permitting inspection in certain parts of the state, and then there are cases where the counties have taken over that. But with all of that, DEQ has a general oversight role over both the county programs and the counties that we directly service. So I'll stop there.
And I should highlight, I did hand out a document here that contains an hour-long presentation. So there's a lot more detail in the slide. So if there's anything that I gloss over or Palmer glosses over too quickly, we can look at that. So I'm going to skip ahead, went over these slides. So last July, we convened the first of the on-site budget note work group, again with this goal of looking at efficiencies and helping rural Oregon. We helped. We held 9 meetings. We published a report in October 2013. We presented the written report. It should have been distributed to you. Hopefully, you got to see that. And now we're doing this. So, the issue that was also raised by that Palmer just mentioned is that we have both DEQ counties and then local government or county run programs. So the counties are contracting with DEQ to run the on-site system. But you can see that we have 12 counties right now, and some of these could be kind of a sea green color because there's some changes that are happening as we're going forward. Clatsop County is working to take the program back over. And there's an issue with Coos and Curry County right now. The DEQ employee just retired, and so they're trying to figure out what they're going to do going forward. So you can see we have a northeast region, eight counties that are currently being serviced by DEQ. There's one person that does inspections out of Umatilla County, I guess Pendleton. As a county employee, I always refer to everything as their county name rather than the city name. And then the other person is out of Baker City. So we set up a couple of goals. One was to increase the flexibility and efficiencies to meet the needs of rural Oregon. And the other one was to just look at administrative improvements in the DEQ program. And rather than go in detail on each of these, this is the summary of the report. We came up with these recommendations at the end of those nine meetings. The ones in bold would require legislative action. I do want to highlight that this was the budget note work group. It wasn't AOC. AOC rejected the strategy number 1A, so I do want to highlight that. The budget note work group did say, though, that the county should be required to run the program statewide. As I ran that past my folks at AOC, they weren't really excited about that. We also discussed contracting with qualified private entities to do field work. After we dug into it a little bit more, we realized that that's actually legal and allowable at this point, so really there's no action that needs to be taken on that one. Allow building inspectors with proper training to conduct pre-cover inspections. One of the issues is that, let's say you're out in Harney County and you have a site that's 100 miles away, we send out building inspectors to do the plumbing inspections. Once it hits the foundation of the home, they can't continue to inspect outward. So one of the thoughts that if we could do the proper training, we could have the plumbing inspector check to make sure that the system is put in correctly. We would allow environmental health inspectors with proper training to conduct pre-cover inspections. Currently, many environmental health specialists can do this, but what we would like to do is encourage more training so that the folks that don't have the proper training have access to that training. We also recommended a sign-off from afar. The idea would be if you have a connection, you could do a Skype type overview where you're just walking around with a video camera, or take a number of digital pictures or a video, send it to a qualified supervisor, and allow them to sign off based on the photos or the video. DEQ and neighboring county staff as supervisors, that's actually allowable now, but we wanted to highlight that for other counties. So you could have someone who is doing training to become a wastewater specialist or an environmental specialist. Those folks could be supervised by a neighboring county. We have an issue in Harney County where they have a person who is a retired soil scientist who probably could teach classes on how to do some of these things, but doesn't have the educational path and the hours of training required. Judge Grasty likes to point out the 2,000 hours of training that were required, the few jobs that they have every year. The gentleman would probably be deceased by the time that he would reach those 2,000 hours. So we would like to provide some flexibility and provide credit for the trainees who have some sort of scientific experience in the right field. And then the other thing we'd like to do is convene a rule advisory committee, because there's a number of rules that we think that really need to be addressed and updated. So those are our efficiency strategies. Again, the ones in bold require legislative action. On the administrative strategies, looking at working with the Building Codes Division to partner on e-permitting, again, just adding efficiency for the citizens, just to allow them easier access. Change record retention requirement to allow electronic copies as official records. There are file cabinets and file cabinets filled with paper records right now all over the state. We'd really like to see those scanned and then have DEQ be the holder of those electronic records. Currently, there's a $100 surcharge that goes to DEQ with every application. The work group suggested that we evaluate that works that fee schedule, especially if we can massage something to get the counties to just run all the programs. I told you that AOC wasn't super excited about having a requirement. Those individual counties are all open to discussion about trying to figure out ways to make that happen. But in the event that happens, we need to evaluate the fee schedule and see where those dollars are going. And that's related to recommendation 2D, which is define the use of the surcharge. When the members of the work group asked where does that surcharge go, while we could get some broad terms, we were looking for more specifics. And then I'm going to turn over 2E and 2F. AOC was supportive of both of these ideas, but asking for some general fund to support compliance work and asking for a similar bill from Senate Bill 83 from the 2000 legislative session, which added some education and outreach. But I'll turn that over to Palmer and let him explain.
Okay. I'll definitely talk about starting with 2E there. The discussion is around, again, going back to what Mark said, the counties are in the position, and understandably so, where they don't want to be told that they have to do the inspection and permitting of on-site septic tank systems. And there's certainly a lot of rural counties we'd be very challenged to try to do anything like that. But it does make a lot of sense to look at having counties at the local level. As Mark said, you have building inspectors are already going out. If we could find a way to co-locate those services where the same person is looking at the septic system while they're also doing the inspection for the building, it saves time for the building owner, and it saves time for the county and the taxpayer at large. So there's a lot of interest in that, but where we ended up, I think, is the counties, again, don't want to be mandated to do it, but they want to work with us and work with the state to transition over and do the work where it makes sense for them. And so what we're talking about is trying to remove barriers to that pathway and find incentives to help that, and that's what 2E is about, as an incentive. You know, would it make sense for the legislature to potentially allocate some money, a pot of money to help counties make that transition or take on that work? So that's what that is about, having a discussion about coming up with a pot of money to help facilitate that. And then 2F was, if I recall the bill correctly, Senate Bill 83 was a bill where right now the penalties that are collected for violations around septic tanks, that penalty money goes into the general fund. The idea was to take at least a portion of that penalty money and redirect it back to outreach and education. So that was the concept. That might be another idea as a potential funding source. I think Legislative Fiscal Office may have strong opinions about that, so that would certainly be something to discuss. But nonetheless, that was the idea.
And just to add to that, when we discussed this at the county level, we felt that this surcharge, when you're applying for a new septic system, you pay this $100 surcharge, that's really supporting compliance work all over the state. And we found that to be a little bit frustrating because there just isn't enough money right now. Pardon me. So when there is an issue, DEQ right now is forced to use the limited funds they have in this program to go out and try to help. And that's where we feel that there could be some help both to DEQ and to the counties if there were some funding offered for compliance work. And and then finishing up our recommendations, there was some feelings amongst a couple of the members that there was that we could do a better job of recruiting wastewater specialists and environmental health specialists by reaching out across the country. So we felt like that was something that could be done. Our next steps.
Can you hold on just a second?
Oh, sure.
Rep. Widener had a question.
Yeah. Just.
You're getting onto some of the compliance stuff and penalties. I'm just wondering how often you run into where the person probably wants to comply, but just because of financial means and everything else. So I'm wondering if the penalties could be making situations worse when we're out there and we shouldn't be looking for ways, financial help for someone. Because you take a senior citizen who has an old septic, and that's usually where this is going to happen, that's lived in their house forever, they're on Social Security, they can't afford $10,000, $15,000 to fix their septic system. So I'm wondering if there shouldn't be something that we should have available to help people rather than go out and fine them when they don't have the money to already pay for it, otherwise they wouldn't take care of it, because most people don't want to see their drain field in that situation. So has there been discussion of that at all?
Chair Boone, Representative, I agree with you. I mean, I think most people, it's in their interest to have a working septic system. I mean, it directly affects your quality of life, having lived in some houses where the drain field was bubbling up and that kind of thing. And then if you want to go to sell the property, it's something that a potential buyer will ask about. So for DEQ, our approach where we have violations or complaints about a problem is we try to work first with the business owner, the homeowner, and then if we are getting to the point where we're not getting a response, then we sort of go to the warning letter. That doesn't work, then we sort of step it up there. But you're right, there are cases where people just aren't financially able to do this very expensive work. So it is something that my agency is talking about. We were having discussions within our agency as we look at what we'll propose to the governor for his recommended budget in 2015 and potentially to the legislature in 2015 about looking at some dollars to help people who are low income, who have failing septic systems, to have some financial assistance. I mean, you know, I don't know if the state can totally pay the whole way, but the state could be there to help the homeowner find a way to do the work. So, because I agree with you, it's a very common situation.
Right. And even like a no interest loan deal or something
exactly.
Like that, to where they can make $100 a month or $50 a month or $200 right. A month, depending upon the size of the septic and everything else, because you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm sure this is more common probably with older people or very low-income people where it's the issue in the situation where somebody who's a little more affluent can go get the loan to get it taken care of.
It is a common problem, and it is particularly bad with low-income households, absolutely.
Representative Benz, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I was just reflecting on how similar the conversation is to the one we've had dozens of times in revenue on the senior property tax deferral program, and it seems like there's a parallel there that could be used. It's interesting because you think it through. Most of the time, the reason for the septic, we just heard about it, concern is groundwater, and so the challenge is trying to keep the groundwater available for drinking purposes. So the two are linked, and so how one might work that out, that might be another angle to look at this problem. But as far as having a source for the funding, we may have one. I really hesitate to say this after what we went through with the senior tax deferral, which got swept, and thus we didn't have enough money, and thus I can see the same thing happening here, and that would be very unfortunate. But it might be a solution we should look at.
Any other questions?
All right.
Can we respond to that?
All right. So our next steps, as I said, AOC did not endorse recommendation 1A. They substituted reduce the impediments to counties to run the program in all counties statewide, and that's how Palmer posed that. And so at this point, DEQ and AOC are planning on discussing joint legislation for the 2015 session. So we'll be working together coming up to try to address these recommendations as best as possible.
I have one brief question.
Sure.
It's just one brief technical question I should have asked a long time ago, but on one of your slides says certain septic systems need ongoing operation and maintenance. Could you break that out for me a little bit, what that means? Is that on an individual homeowner, or by design, or size of system, or this? What's that mean?
Representative Reardon, if you'd like, and if I might, Chair Boone, we have a gentleman here, Mike Kaczynski, who used to be the statewide program manager for on-site system, and he would really be the best person to answer that question. So if I can,
absolutely.
I'd like to have him come
yeah,
up.
Yeah, he can come up.
You don't mind taking the time.
No,
really
it's
like
fine. This is great. Welcome.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Rick Wendy.
This just kind of sums up committee today, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Ending on septic systems.
That's been a great committee.
I can bring the kids back. Is that
We can talk about digesters. Yeah.
Chair Boone, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Kaczynski, Michael Kaczynski with the EQ. And to answer the question, Representative Reardon, it depends on the type of system. Some of these ATT systems that were described in the South Deschutes County presentation, ones with pumps and filters, more complex systems, they're the ones that really need the ongoing operation and maintenance. And this is probably 95% plus the residential, individual, single-family dwellings. Mm-hmm. So that responsibility would fall on the homeowner. And the determination of that type of system depends on the soil and groundwater conditions at that site.
Any questions? I have one quick question before Rep. Bentz. He has all the questions. Are you related to the Unabomber?
Chair Boone, no, it is spelled differently, for the record.
Sorry, I had to ask. Now, Rep. Bentz, what if you'd said yes?
Yeah, right.
I actually almost saw him in... But that's another story for another committee.
I made sure Mike didn't bring his hoodie, so.
Okay.
How much further can we digress?
I know. Please,
that
Rep.
Bentz.
Bring
just,
it home.
I just want to mention the work being done to try to help get this technical work done out in these remote, faraway areas is extraordinarily important because the additional cost, as you know, that's imposed upon any construction activity as a result of having to bring people from 2 days' drive away dampens anybody's enthusiasm for doing anything. And so I'm very, very happy you're working on that. I'm glad that Judge Grasty was involved because I'm sure that was what his focus was at more levels than just this one. So I really do appreciate the work on it, particularly trying to find folks who are adequately educated to do the job and perhaps the taking photographs and all the electronic stuff we've got will allow us, you, to do the job at less cost for our remote areas. So thank you for that work.
Appreciate that.
Now, this is a serious comment. I just want you to know up front. So stop laughing. This is yet again another use for drones or unmanned, you know, aerial photography. Just a suggestion. As long as you can rein them in. Well, thank you very much. It's very interesting, and we look forward to seeing that joint or commingled legislation.
Yes.
Being efficient. Is there anything else to come before our committee today? Anybody have any last words? All right, we stand adjourned.